Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Revision Energy. Sunbug Solar is now part of Revision Energy, a solar installer committed to being a renewable energy partner for New England and working to fight climate change. Learn more at sunbugsolar.com.
Today on Boston Public Radio, is the Trump administration's strategy on climate change to bury its own scientific report? Why did such a media-savvy president release one of the most comprehensive studies to date, one that details the toll climate change will have on the U.S. economy on a day when most of us were bargain hunting on Black Friday? Stupid question, I know. We take on this and more on today's Politics Roundup. Then medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us to talk about the vexing anti-vaxxers and how families who opt out of vaccinations have put a pox on a North Carolina school where dozens of students have been infected with chickenpox.
It's Cyber Monday, and with our dependency on online retailers growing, so is our demand to have day of delivery. But is it worth the human cost? We open the lines and ask you if we're ready to give up our own gratification until working conditions at these places improve. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89. WGBH. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, our first post-Thanksgiving show.
How was Thanksgiving?
It's great. How was yours?
You know why it was really good? Because I decided, I mean, in all seriousness, I decided, you know, who I'm really grateful for. It was really great. Myself. You didn't hear the president say he's grateful for himself?
And
I figured
by,
if he can be, then...
Have you two done wonderful things for your country, Jim?
No, I didn't say for my country, but I've done really wonderful things.
Around the dining room?
Just grateful for myself.
Stuffing was great?
Last Thursday, speaking of, President Trump said U.S. troops could do whatever necessary to guard the border against migrant caravans.
If they have to, they're going to use lethal force. I've given the okay. Yeah, if they have to, I hope they don't have to. But, you know, you're dealing with a minimum of 500 serious criminals. So I'm not going to let the military be taken advantage of. I have no choice. Do I want that to happen? Absolutely not. But you're dealing with rough people. You ask the people in Tijuana, Mexico. They opened up with wide arms. Just come in, let me help you, let us take care of you. And within 2 days, now they're going crazy to get them out. They want them out. Because things are happening. Bad things are happening in Tijuana.
Well, bad has gotten worse amid heated rhetoric from the president and confusion over a reported deal to keep asylum seekers in Mexico, with Mexico, by the way. All traffic was halted yesterday at the border crossing between San Diego and Tijuana, and U.S. border agents were firing tear gas and rubber bullets. Is this the inevitable reality of migration, or is the consequence of the president's caravan fear-mongering ahead of the midterm elections? Join us to talk about this and other headlines with Jennifer Nasur and Michael Curry. Jennifer is the former chair of the Massachusetts GOP, founder of Conservative Women for a Better Future, and of counsel Rubin and Rudman, attorneys at law. Jennifer, good to see you. Michael Curry is senior vice president and general counsel at the Mass League of Community Health Centers and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Hello, Michael, to you.
Hey, hi.
So, Michael, let's start with you. I know everybody knows we can't have open borders. We have more kids, 14,000 unaccompanied children in U.S. United States custody right now. Front page of the New York Post today, and probably other places as well, had this really awful picture of a woman with two small children, one of them in diapers, running away from the tear gas. So far, we've had some Democrats, very few Republicans, complaining about this. Is this just another Trump thing that gets brushed aside, or what?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. When I saw the images, I immediately thought of a quote from a movie, Birth of a Movement, which is about the D.W. Griffith film, Birth of a Nation. And there's a line in the film that says, if you can diminish a people, if you can mischaracterize them, you can get away with doing almost anything to them. And I think essentially that's what's happened here, is that Donald Trump has been a master at characterizing people coming to our borders, especially our southern borders, as being criminals, thugs. They're going to take your jobs. They're going to rape your families. And that now has created at least probably a piece of the nation, a half the nation or less, an apathy or an indifference to what we're seeing on television. It's disturbing. And I think that we have to all speak up. These are kids. These were kids being tear gassed, and women. And quite frankly, even men who are looking for an opportunity. So it's disturbing.
What do you think, Jennifer? Do you think there's going to be an outcry about this or no?
So I guess there are two ways to look at this, right? So from a human rights perspective and from a perspective of a mom with children, you know, it's heartbreaking to see. However, this president, this isn't the first time he has made statements that people are not coming into this country anymore. They're not coming in illegally. They're not trying to come in by submitting their papers and, you know, waiting it out like other people do who come to the country legally. And so I think, you know, I don't agree with any use of force. However, I don't know how the message gets out there, right? So how else does the president, does the administration, or any law enforcement get the message, listen, we have a procedure. This is the United States of America. This is our procedure. You have to follow our procedure. So again, heartbreaking as it is, this isn't new news. And so I think that these people have to understand that, you know, they need to follow the rules that are being given.
But even if you're right, and even if the majority of Americans, even if they don't like the way he's doing it, most Americans don't think we should have whatever the BS line is, open borders, which I've never heard a Democrat say we should just let anybody in.
Right.
Who want? What evidence is there that any of the things that he has proposed or implemented, including having 5,000 troops spend Thanksgiving doing absolutely nothing on the border, is furthering the goal? And the weird part
is
considering that the president of the United States is fixated, which is, I guess, fine, on politics, it didn't work in the midterm elections. I mean, it really didn't. The Republicans won Senate seats that they were likely to win, and we're going to talk about another one still up for grabs, and there was a wipeout in the House. So who is it? Who is the base that he's appealing to?
It's the same people. It's the 36% that will vote for him no matter what. It's the people who, if he shot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue in the head,
yeah, right,
would still vote for him. It's the same people. Those are the only people he's appealing to.
And those are the same people who think, despite his own government coming out with a climate report that, lo and behold, was issued not just on a Friday. And we all know Democrats and Republicans put out things they don't want it to get any press on a Friday. But picking Black Friday is even better if you want nobody to read about it while you're out shopping and that sort of stuff. You know, I remember the line, we don't have the sound right now, when he says to Leslie Stahl, you know, who are these on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago, who are these scientists? Well, the answer, Mr. President, is they're your scientists who say by the end of this century, forget the 2040 deadline in that report from the UN, the U.S. economy is going to be ravaged.
Well, the farmlands, I mean, that was one
in
of the
Midwest,
big
right?
We're not going to be able to produce this food anymore because the Midwest is going to be facing such terrible droughts.
So forget for a moment the president, who is in total denial for whatever reason. Do we get silence from Republicans in the Senate, for example, on this, despite the near unanimity of their own government report here? Is there continue to be denial there too, Jennifer?
You know, I mean, that's going to be, the music that they're going to have to face at this point, whether they are able to take, and I'm hoping that the midterms, if we learned anything, was a good little slap in the face for the Republican Party to sit back and do a little self-evaluation and for them to maybe grow a set of balls to be able to get out there and to go against the president.
It's
and
a legal
say,
term for those who don't know that expression. She learned that.
Well, right?
Well, they're mostly men in the Republican Party. And for them to actually be able to say, listen, you know, this is something serious that we now need to tackle. And oh, by the way, as Republicans, we need to find something new because the same old has not been working for us. So maybe jumping on the climate change bandwagon would be good for the Senate too.
And just a comment to that is, and the four of us have had this conversation before. It reminds me, it's the tail wagging the dog. I mean, the president has controlled the conversation so often that even Republicans are just silent because he's delivering on some of the things they've wanted. So they're complicit. And I think this is just another example where if we do not hear them respond to the findings in this report, it's literally Armageddon in some of the things that we will start to see over the course of the next several decades if this is not addressed. This is disturbing again that Republicans aren't willing to challenge this president in places where they should.
We're talking to Michael Curry and Jennifer Nassour.
So we've got a race in Mississippi tomorrow, the runoff between Mike Espy, who is a former Clinton-Obama guy, Black guy, and this woman.
Was he Secretary of Agriculture? Is that what he was?
I think he was Secretary of Agriculture. Yeah. And this Cindy Hyde Smith woman who said some pretty racist things about being in the front row of a hanging and that sort of stuff. But apparently she's still ahead in the polls. and she's probably going to win. What do you make of this, Mike Espy?
You know, one is I think Mike Espy is a great candidate. I think that's why Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and many others are down there now campaigning for him. I think that's why the Democratic
Ayanna Pressley,
Party,
by the way.
Ayanna as well, a good friend of mine, is down there as well. And money by the parties being put into trying to give her an opportunity to win. It is, you know, I love politics, and I love that we have Republicans and Democrats who run for seats. But it disturbs me again when we have a candidate who is clearly racist and who was race baiting and playing on the whole notion of hangings and lynchings. I am reminded every time I look at history and think about history, those images of the large crowds of white people staring at a black body hanging on a tree, smiling and celebrating. And she played on that. I think if you think about Mississippi, the NAACP put out a report some time ago that between 1882 and 1968, about 581 lynchings happened in Mississippi. It was the home, the birth, the home for lynchings in this country. She should be ashamed of herself, and she knew what she was doing.
You have anything to say about Ms. Hyde Smith?
You know, I'm all for women running and being elected. And, you know, I'm struggling with this because, you know, I mean, look, at the end of the day, do I think she's going to win? Absolutely, I think she's going to win. It's Mississippi. And for a Republican not to win there, she's not Roy Moore. It doesn't rise to that level. So
I think it's pretty close. I mean, she hasn't committed crimes like he was credibly accused of. But by the way, it's not just this put me in the front row of the hanging thing. She went to the segregated school specifically to avoid being with African Americans. She sent her kid.
Seen with a Confederate flag.
I mean, this is really, this is
another
era.
So here's the thing, though. I was having this discussion with a young woman who said, you know, Marsha Blackburn is not the person that I would ever vote for.
It's Tennessee.
And in Tennessee. Yeah. And I was in New York doing a panel there. And I looked at the young woman and I said, well, so here's the thing. You don't live in Tennessee.
But Marsha Blackburn and Hyde Smith are two totally different animals.
Right, 100%. But what I'm saying is she's not representing us. She's representing the people of Mississippi. Their thought process is very different. It is a very sad – to me, anything that has to do with race relations, putting women back to, you know, being in the kitchen barefoot and pregnant, I think all very bad notions that people should not be discussing. I was watching Outlander last night, and there was a hanging. And, you know, when you're looking at that today and you're saying, oh, my God, that actually – stuff like that actually – you know, it's horrible. It's horrible history. But I don't think that that's going to kill her election.
You know, but while you're right, obviously, the people of Mississippi make the decision, which is horrifying to me. She makes the decision for us about whether Brett Kavanaugh goes on the Supreme Court of the United States. And by the way, speaking of that, one of the great stories that also got lost in the shuffle last week is good for John Roberts. After Donald Trump criticizes a judge in one of these asylum cases as being an Obama judge and trashes the Ninth Circuit, which is more liberal than others, John Roberts, in almost the Chief Justice of the United States, in unprecedented fashion, respectfully says they're not Obama judges. There are no Trump judges. And when I read his thing and I'm saying good for him for having the courage to do this, I'm saying to myself, so does Donald Trump respond to this because he never lets anybody else get the last word? And Trump, of course, responds to that in further tweets. But I have to say, I mean, there's no question that people who are appointed by Barack Obama, for the most part, are going to be more liberal. And there's no question people appointed by Trump are going to be more conservative. But how does that not undercut America's faith in the judicial system when Donald Trump is essentially saying you can't trust a significant swath of the judges who you appear in front of?
So, I mean, Roberts was appointed by George W. So, I mean, you know, it's not that he was appointed by Clinton or Obama or, you know, Jimmy Carter. I mean, he was appointed by a, you know, pretty decently conservative Republican. If Roberts is always the swing vote and he's Chief Justice and there's no respect. I think that the most important part here is Civics 101. clearly the president missed that class because there's a separation of powers between the judiciary and the executive branch. And I think that, you know, Trump needs to really figure his place out. Everyone knows the Ninth Circuit is nuts. Like in law school, that is the one thing everyone always says.
Very liberal.
Right. It just there's always the craziest decisions that come out of the Ninth. But, you know, all in all, I mean, these judges are doing what they were put on the bench to do.
By the way, Roberts was the swing vote on health care, on the Affordable Care. He's not always. There's
he's the
a
more
hope
moderate.
That he will be. Yeah, going forward.
I have a question for you on Roberts. I wondered, Michael Curry, whether he could become, as you said, the swing vote on a lot of issues. I mean, he undermined voting rights last time around, saying, oh, we're a different country now. Obviously, we're not a different country now because the moment they allowed voting rights to be undermined, all over these southern states, they were being undermined.
Right.
So what do you think that in terms of his going forward, especially involving race stuff?
Well, I think, and we, meaning many of us in the civil rights community, opposed his appointment and still maintain that he was a horrible thing for civil rights, appointing him to the Supreme Court. We were elated at the Affordable Care Act decision. But the reality is we will take hits around the voting rights. We'll take hits in many areas that we care about. And Kavanaugh is just tipping the scale the other direction. Roberts is interesting. I think people try to cast him in this light of being now more moderate, more the swing vote, when in fact he's never been.
He's more moderate than Kavanaugh and Clarence Thomas.
I guess it's relative, right?
It is relative.
So the reality is we now have a court that is a runaway conservative court that is going to change many of the things that that we fought so hard to get.
But it's only
going to
be for 30 years, Michael. So it's
only
nothing
for a lifetime.
Exactly.
I don't know about that with the president fighting with Roberts. I don't know if that's going to actually happen. I think that Roberts could actually say, you know what, screw yourself.
But we got to go to a break in a second. But after he saw, for example, what happened in Georgia, I mean, I would think if he had any humility, he might consider that he was wrong. This is Roberts.
Yeah.
You don't think so?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think he is who he is. I think almost kind of aligning with Trump on this point, people are appointed for a reason. And I think we've even discussed that here because of their political affiliations, because of the speeches they've written or given, the writings they've had. They're there to deliver on certain voices. That's the anti-Roe v. Wade. That's the protect the Second Amendment. Don't let them take away your guns. There is no doubt that the conservative appointees that are on that Supreme Court are there to deliver certain votes. And now the scale is tipped, and now we'll see what happens with those votes.
Okay, we're talking politics with Jennifer Nasur and Michael Curry. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. Again, if you're just tuning in, we're in the middle of our primary, whatever, we're talking politics. It's with Jennifer Nasur, the former chair of the Mass GOP, and Michael Curry, a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors.
So here's one of my theories. People up in Andover, Lawrence, freezing, Thanksgiving's 17 degrees out, 16 degrees out. They still have no heat. The Columbia gas explosion, we all remember that. Senators Markey and Warren are having a hearing up there about what's taken them so long. It seems to me, Michael Curry, that National Grid is making fools out of a lot of our politicians because they have workers on a lockout that could perhaps be used up in North.
Who Air. Volunteered to
yeah.
help out.
But, but nothing's happening and they're still in the lockout and the people up in North Andover and Lawrence are still freezing.
Yeah. National Grid, shame on them for their stance on this lockout. And I've driven by and honked the horn many a times. I see those workers. We have a challenge because I think both with the disaster, National Grid, Columbia Gas, there are some inherent problems with how we deliver gas in Massachusetts and probably across the country, even with its parent company, NiSource. When I heard this story, I immediately, as a former auditor, you thought to myself, do they not do control risk assessments? Do they not document what could potentially go wrong? And are they not required to do that? And where's the regulatory oversight? And of course, NTSB comes back with issues not only on the Columbia Gas side, but also probably industry-wide around where there's a lack of oversight, a lack of responsibility, and lack of professional engineers to review these the transportation, the delivery of gas, and hazardous materials.
Interesting. I got a maybe last week, the week before, I got a little notice from National Grid saying, you know, we'd like to come in and check all of the pipes to the houses. Isn't that interesting?
Really?
Yeah, in Boston.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's good that they're checking the pipes, right?
No, I thought that was so, you know,
well,
hey, National Grid, thank you.
They're sending people who aren't highly trained
right.
as compared to the people who were locked out of their
yes,
jobs.
Right. Yes, and those are the people that we need, right? We need the professionals. So good for them to be sending out those notices, but it would be much better if they don't get into the Columbia Gas situation where it's people who, you know, the people who really know, the professionals, the qualified people, there aren't enough of them, and so they send out the other people.
Let me quote my favorite person, who would be me, and I've said this like 50 times. The legislature should meet when it ends its five-month vacation.
Haven't they ended?
No, and no. statutorily say that a public utility may not, under any circumstance, ever lock out their workers.
When are they back to
period,
work?
January.
Yeah,
that's
I mean, yeah,
it's for public safety issue.
Wait, $115,000. How much do they make
whatever
to do
make.
Absolutely
they make
nothing?
Hey, can we move to something? An incredible story to me. I don't know the police commissioner very well. But I know that one of the things, this is Willie Gross, obviously, who took over for Bill Evans. And one of the things, that the videos that when I first encountered Gross, I'd met him a few times, was at some demonstration where he was so under control dealing with a disgusting bunch of young people who were cursing. And
it was the shooting of the police officer.
Whatever it was. Some kids were, young people were totally out. He was so measured. Well, let me tell you something. When I heard about this Facebook posting that he did trashing the local chapter of the Civil Liberties Union, and by the way, we have the new commissioner will start being with us soon regularly. The head of the Civil Liberties Union, Carol Rose, is with us every single month. What do you make of this, Mike? This is pretty heavy. He didn't mince words here
you
at
know,
all.
I'm disappointed. I'm a friend of Commissioner Gross and frustrated with him because it's the typical police playbook. To be defensive, to be protecting of the data. The reality is he handled this wrong. I can tell you for a fact that Sarah Wunsch, the head of ACLU, the leadership there, Rahsaan Hall, my good friend, attorney Rahsaan Hall, care about the shooting of the police officer on Humboldt Avenue, contrary to what the commissioner said. They care about these families, the mothers and fathers that are losing their kids on the street. They're worried about MS-13 like the rest of us. But they're challenging the Boston police to do the right thing around discrimination and how it polices. He should embrace
collection
that
collection of data on alleged gang members,
exactly.
We should say.
He
That's
should embrace that conversation. He should meet with them. He should and let it play out in the courts if it needs to play out in the courts. What he did was he did what all of us are subject to. Don't emote on Facebook. Because, you know, if you emote on Facebook, you say things you shouldn't say that are inappropriate. And then you want to take them back and you can't. And I'm disappointed
in the commissioner.
On his
own personal Facebook page.
Personal Facebook page. But he's in a position of power and leadership. So for him to disparage the ACLU for the tremendous amount of work they do here and across the country was extremely disappointing for the commissioner. And I think he should retract what he said.
By the way, he called them paper warriors. He said, they're not there. And I'm paraphrasing this part. They're not there when we go visit the mother of a victim. They're not there, etc., etc. What do you think of what Gross did?
You know what? I understand. So I agree with Michael on the I don't love the tweeting out emotions and Facebook posting emotions. And I'm not on Facebook because I don't want to read it and I don't want to see it. So I agree there. What I don't agree with is they're collecting data. And that's data that they need to be able to make decisions and to go track people and follow people. And that, to me, if that information got out there, that's information that the gang members could use to get away from the police. And so I feel like that is their information. They have a right to keep that information private. I mean, he said that the ACLU didn't participate in a trip to El Salvador to learn about MS-13, that they don't participate in the anti-crime programs, that they don't offer support when an officer is wounded and shot. but they're not participating in that end of it. And so, and what the police are doing is they're here to protect us. And the ACLU is not. That is not their job. And so I think that the police have to do what they are empowered to do, which is to protect the people.
And their job as the ACLU is to challenge the Boston police and law enforcement to do the right thing and how it polices. That's them doing their job. It's his job to be responsive to what the public is concerned about. And the public is the people who support the ACO, like myself and many others. He has an obligation to take those complaints, those challenges seriously. And ultimately, as we just saw play out in the arrest of Kevin Williams, an innocent man who was arrested, spent five weeks in jail for murder for the man on Dorchester Avenue. Police make
gas
mistakes.
Station, guy at the gas station.
Police make mistakes. Police have misjudgments. They're bad policies, bad people, bad practices. And thank God for the ACLU to challenge those.
Yeah, but his first job and the police department's first job is public safety. And to make sure that everyone is safe, that is their first job. Being responsive is a part of it, but it is not their first job.
Michael Carr, we have only a minute left, but can you explain how this Kevin Williams, the 21-year-old, spent 5 weeks in jail for a murder he didn't commit?
Yeah, you know, and I know the commissioner and others in BPD are not going to like this, but I do compare it to the Stewart murder case, and that people are so rushed to find the person who did it that they then run through underrepresented communities, and they can just rampantly arrest and snatch up people who look like me. And they've done that for generations.
What was the guy's name? Willie Bennett?
Willie Bennett. Yeah. And I was immediately reminded that all transparency, Kevin Williams, my nephew. So imagine,
oh my God.
My nephew,
I
immediately called the police commissioner, the mayor's office, the DA's office, and said, hey, you arrested the wrong kid.
He was home with his mother.
He was home with his mother. He had just walked out. There's a Homeland Security BPD camera right outside of his home. We told them within 2 days, pull the camera. You'll see him walking out of his house around the corner of his girlfriend's house. They kept him in jail for 5 weeks. It's the way our system works. It's the adversarial.
Even after your calls?
Even after the calls. It's the adversarial nature, because as soon as you kick into the adversarial nature of our legal system, kids can sit in prison and think about it. All that access, he spent 5 weeks in jail.
And disrupted his life.
Disrupted his life.
Traumatized.
Trauma. Cannot sleep at night, having trouble sleeping. It's changed his life. And the reality is.
And when you Google his name, by the way, even though ultimately the charges were dropped, the first thing that someone's going to see for the rest of his life is this.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know it was your nephew. Thank you for sharing that with us. Well,
Thank you both very
good
much for coming
both.
In. Jennifer Nassour is former chairwoman of the Mass GOP, founder of Conservative Women for a Better Future, and counsel to Rubin and Rudman, attorneys at law. Michael Curry is senior vice president and general counsel at Mass League of Community Health Centers and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Jennifer and Michael, thank you very much for coming in. Coming up, medical ethicist Art Kaplan is here. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And the Trump administration has approved again rules for some of Kentucky's Medicaid recipients, which requires them to work or volunteer or go to school in order to keep their health coverage. The initial effort to implement this was blocked earlier this year by a federal judge who, in his ruling, chastised the Trump administration for failing to consider Kentucky's own internal estimate that as many as 95,000 people could lose their Medicaid coverage or health coverage within the first 5 years after those work requirements took effect. So what will that mean for the state now if these Medicaid requirements, new but similar, don't get blocked this time around? Joining us to talk about this, the vexing consequences of the anti-vaxxers, and other medical headlines is Art Kaplan. Art is a doctor's William F. and Virginia Connolly Mini Chair and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art.
Hi, Art.
Hello, hello.
Hello. So, Art, let's start with Kentucky and Medicaid restrictions. And I'll make the conservative argument from the governor there, which is that he's asking for people to spend at least 80 hours per month either to education, job training, or volunteer work or a job itself. So why is that terrible?
Well, remember, the overwhelming majority of people on Medicaid in Kentucky and every state are disabled or children or single head of household females. So getting them out 80 hours a week to do anything is very, very difficult, unless we're going to reinstitute child labor. So you've got a population that basically is highly needy or is trying to take care of a bunch of kids, and that's where the problem is. There's also a minor problem in that opportunities for these people in terms of saying, you know, here's a job you could go to, here's something you could volunteer for. It's not enough to throw them out into the pond and say, go swim. would be useful to say, here's the list of things we've got that you can go do. It's not clear that all they're going to do is wind up working flipping burgers at a McDonald's where they have to hire daycare help for the four kids. So it's, I don't know, this idea that you have to work to earn Medicaid just strikes me as cruel. It's not really something that I think is going to instill good habits or get people off of Medicaid.
Yeah, I want to get lost in the weeds on this, and maybe you don't even know this, but from the two stories I read on it, on the new requirement, it seems that the new requirement is the old requirement with a little window dressing that the courts ruled had legal problems. So if I'm right, if you know, why do they assume they're going to do any better in round two than they did in round one?
I don't think they are going to do any better. I think it's window dressing. I think they're still trying to get a work for Medicaid requirement through. The court didn't like it the first time. Court probably won't like it the next time.
So, Art Kaplan, let's move on to this chicken pox outbreak at this school, private school in North Carolina, where 3 dozen students, a quarter of the student body, have come down with chicken pox. And apparently a lot of these kids have gotten religious exemptions from vaccinations. I don't understand
Neither
how that can be legitimate, that because you have – I mean, if that's your – is this because it's a private school, or I just don't understand how you can get a religious exemption when you're putting other children at risk?
Yeah, well, some states do permit religious exemptions. I think 16 of them, if I'm not mistaken, and some permit both religious and what's called a philosophical or conscientious objection. California recently tightened up its statute and said no exemptions except for medical issues. Let's say you had AIDS or something, you can't build resistance when you get vaccinated. There's no point in giving it to you. Or some people have certain kinds of allergies that might pose problem, let's say, for egg-based vaccines. But that state saw an increase in vaccination. The other states that continue to put up with either religious or philosophical objection, you get pockets of people saying, well, I'm just not going to do it. And here's the real issue. We did a review out of NYU, my shop, last year, and checked with all the major religions. None of them oppose vaccination. I mean, nobody. There's maybe a little Christian Science opposition because they don't really go to doctors.
Right.
Everybody else, they're Catholics, Muslims, Jews. They don't really care. In fact, the Catholic Church says you should get vaccinated to protect the community. It's more of a duty to help others. And so this idea that there's a religious objection, I think, is bogus because I don't think religions object. Most of them were formed long before vaccination was invented, so they don't have anything to say about it.
Well, even if they did, though, I think the initial point that Marjorie makes is pretty relevant if someone decided to challenge this, namely that it's not just you with a religious objection which relates to your own family, which I'm troubled by, if you impose it on your children. But because it's other people are affected by it. So it seems to me it's a public health thing.
Yeah,
which,
stay home.
Right.
If you don't want to get it. If you
or whatever it is.
You can't come to school.
And, you know, by the way, it's not just this whole anti-vax thing is almost upsetting to me as the climate change deniers. Renee Graham, who's a local columnist in the Boston Globe, did a great piece.
She did a terrific piece.
About how you can't be a pro-vaccine and anti-flu, not do the flu thing. And I was stunned. No state vaccinates more than half of their people. In fact, the highest vaccination rate in the United States is Massachusetts, which is 49.7%.
Is this for flu?
Yeah, which kills what 85,000 people a year or whatever it is in America. So is this laziness? This can't be 50% of the people and more can't be anti-vaxxers. The vast majority of these people are probably too lazy to do it, right? Or are they? What is it?
So here's what I hear. One group says, I'm not going to get it because it gave me the flu. Common statement.
Right.
It can't give you the flu. It's not made out of anything that would transmit the flu. But what happens is this. You can get the flu up to, I don't know, 4 or 5 days before you actually get symptoms. So a significant number of people who delay getting the flu vaccine are going to have the flu when they get the flu vaccine, and it'll be too late. So I think that's what's going on with that. If you get the flu shot earlier, like today, and you don't wait till the middle of the flu season, you're not going to, quote-unquote, get it from the shot, which is bogus. some people just don't like needles. I mean, there is a wimpy factor out there. They just sort of say, you know, I don't really like the needle, and I don't want to get it, and I don't have much sympathy for that either. It's like, you know, man up, get in there, put on your big boy pants, get the shot. It's good for you, protects others. The other issue sometimes for flu shots, people say convenience, but I don't know. Is there a CVS or a Walmart?
Exactly, now that they do it, right.
Yeah, they do.
And it's free in 99% of the cases because
they
charge your insurance.
When you pick up a prescription, do you want a flu shot?
So, Art, is it?
You know, one other thing on the flu vaccine. There were a lot of stories last year that said it didn't work so well. So people thought, well, if it didn't work well, then I'm not going to bother. But even when it's not preventing the flu, it makes getting the flu much easier. That is, it still reduces symptoms. So you want to get it, even if, you know, it's not 100% perfect, it makes the flu last a shorter time, and you have far less nasty symptoms, probably worth something in terms of being able to go back to work and that sort of thing. So even though, it's not 100% effective every year, it still helps tune down the flu.
By the way, there are no scientific arguments at all that the anti-vaxxers, from autism that the president talked about to whatever else, there are no scientific arguments that hold water against this. Is that correct?
That is correct. There's like nothing dangerous, unsafe, autistic-inducing about the flu vaccine. Nothing.
But, you know, one more thing about the chickenpox vaccine, because I remember when this came into being, I think it was in the late 90s, early 2000s, when they could give it to you for school. It was late, much later than measles, mumps, rubella, et cetera. You have to keep getting it every 10 years, I understand. And so you wonder about the awareness about that, that people are just going to forget or they're not going to know because you get it when you're 4 years old or something.
Doctors really have to pay attention and ask about did you get a booster? That is something we're not seeing enough of, getting nagged about getting boosters. Tetanus, you know, even has to get readministered normally. Nobody thinks about it until you cut yourself on a piece of metal outside and then say, oh, have you had a tetanus shot lately? Well, let's give you one. So we're not really keeping up to date on vaccinations the way we should. That is a problem, Margie. That really is.
You know, by the way, if people are nervous about, you say, needles, I got a flu shot at Walgreens a couple of months ago. I just bought myself a pop after, you know, like a lollipop. In case they weren't going to do it, you just administer it yourself. And so it's sort of, you pat yourself on the head. You were a really good patient, Mr. Brody, and that sort of thing, whatever it is.
Okay.
We're talking to Art Kaplan there. You know, Art, I like ease of access to records, but this whole Google health record thing scares the you-know-what out of me. Could you describe what they're doing and whether we should be worried or not?
Well, it's a British company, I can't remember the name of it, that had basically tracking health information in Britain, and that's pretty complicated information, that is, a lot of it, because they're watching the National Health Service, and so it's one system, and they know everything about everybody. Google owns that company, and they said, well, we'll own it, but one thing we'll promise you is we'll never merge it in with Big Google so that we'll never make links between health information and what your search engine shows or all the other things that people use Google for, and then they did. And so it looks like they're going to start exactly correlating information on, you know, are you searching for headache remedies or do you have something that's itching you and seeing whether it's in the health records of people, at least so far in the UK, and then starting to market stuff to them and sell them stuff and so on. I don't trust these companies when they say, we're never going to do X. They always wind up doing X.
Well, especially since they did promise they were never going to do X, and they did it. So this, go ahead. By the way, it's called DeepMind is the name of the company in the
UK. DeepMind, that's it. Yeah. And so I think what you got to do is you got to put some penalties in place. We don't have those. Saying basically, if you look at my health record and you don't have my explicit consent to do that, then you're going to pay, you know, a $1,000 fine every time you do that. We can regulate it, but until we put some teeth into the thing, all we're relying on is their promises, and they're not really worth that much.
But, you know, but that's not enough as far as I'm concerned, because we've talked to the Attorney General of Massachusetts about this quite a bit after these breaches have happened, not this, but other breaches. And sometimes the companies don't even tell us about the breaches for months and months and months, if not years. And there are probably some breaches we've never been told about. And obviously an enforcement penalty only works if you know that you have been violated, right? So,
well, that's fair enough. But I think, you know, people want to regulate, but they don't want to put penalties on. So let's say we need both. You ought to have some penalty if you don't disclose. That's pretty whopping. And then per person, you ought to have a penalty if you touch data without consent. So I think I know what the answer is, and I think I know why it's not happening. It's the lobbying power of the companies. I think, what was it, New York City and Crystal City, Virginia, just spent $1 million to attract Google? It doesn't look like
Amazon.
Amazon. Mm-hmm. That doesn't look like politicians are of a mind to go after these big data-heavy companies because they want the business, they want the jobs. And boy, are they powerful, right? I assume listeners have been tracking that ridiculous Facebook story about.
We're going to talk about it at noon, yeah.
Yeah, hiring people, opposition research, basically deny. So we're up against mighty powerful juggernauts. And again, the only way you're going to get them to pay attention is not just regs, but regs with penalties, which we don't have.
Talking to Art Kaplan, medical ethicist.
So Art Kaplan, the head of Housing and Urban Development, Ben Carson, apparently is coming under some criticism because HUD-subsidized properties, according to the Daily Kos, are failing their health and safety inspections at a rate more than 30% higher than in 2016. Exposed wiring, missing smoke detectors, bug infestations, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, he's not coming under more pressure because no one can find him. So How's he going to be under more pressure? It's like he's on milk cartons now. I mean, have you seen Ben Carson since he was sworn in, Art Kaplan?
No, I have not.
I have not. And by the way, the reason this becomes a big health issue is if you live in miserable, rotten, unsafe housing, whether it's lead exposure or you got leaks that are causing mold, these are major health threats. Again, you know, you've heard me whine in the past that we spend all our time worrying about genetic testing ourselves, and that's nice. But if you live in a cesspool, and that's where you put poor people, and you don't make landlords make repairs, and you don't beef up the housing, you're going to get people really sick. And so where is Ben Carson? I haven't seen him. I find myself thinking maybe he ran away back to do more surgery, which apparently he was pretty good at Johns Hopkins, because I certainly have not seen this guy anywhere.
But, you know, some people are suggesting that maybe not the failure to respond to deal with these serious repair needs, but he's a big self-reliance kind of guy.
Isn't he
raising the rents on Section 8, subsidized housing, based on the notion that if it costs more, you're more likely to be forced out, and if you're forced out, you're going to be forced to be on your own kind of thing? I mean, that...
I think there's an element that we were talking about earlier. For some reason, Trump Republicans have gotten in their head that work is good for those who are reliant on Medicaid. Remember, data keeps showing if you want to make a dent in the opioid epidemic, get people on Medicaid and then get them into treatment. That'll save their lives. But this work for your health insurance, or don't lie around like, and I'm going to use this metaphor deliberately, a welfare, Cadillac welfare person, right, in the luxury of your broken down tenement building with no elevator and bugs crawling all over the place. Don't get used to that luxurious life. We'll make it hard in there, and then you'll work hard. You'll earn your Medicaid, and you'll be out of public housing. I don't think it works that way.
You know, I was reading this story about Ben Carson and HUD and subsidized housing juxtaposed to another story somewhere I read over the weekend about how they've got to raise the salaries for employees in Congress that are making like $40,000 and $50,000.
So they can afford housing in both
cities.
Exactly. Off the Ocasio-Cortez story.
Well, never mind both cities. These are people that live – these are not the Congress people. These are their staffers that live full-time in Washington, D.C., and they're talking about how the rent has become so expensive that if you're making $40,000, $50,000 a year, you can't afford even a one-bedroom apartment or even a studio apartment. And so only rich people can afford to go work for these congressmen and women.
Are you telling me there's no housing in rural Virginia? What are you saying?
I guess they have to take a long
ride. Can they commute 9 hours each
way? Yeah, exactly, if they can increase their commute. So let's move on to another story that is always just – it's just – to me, horrible. There's been a lot of efforts to ban female genital mutilation in the United States of America, but a federal court just ruled that this is a state responsibility and not the federal government can't do this?
And by the way, the reason it's – I didn't even know it was happening at this kind of volume. Is this because of religious things that
– Yes.
Okay.
Go ahead. So this is religious communities. I think the opinion involved a decision in Michigan. There are a ton of folks who historically have moved to Michigan in some pretty orthodox Muslim communities where the practice is – sort of, I don't want to say flourished, that's not true, but it's been around. You know, Marjorie, I don't think this was a moral position on the legitimacy of female circumcision. I think it was just one of these jurisdictional fights again, somebody saying, you can't do that at the federal level, the states have authority.
Yeah, that's
over
what he was saying, yeah.
And you got to get the state to fix it. Hopefully, the state will fix it. Look, I understand there's a lot of battling about male circumcision, but female circumcision is obviously mutilation intended to desexualize the woman. And it's worse. It's just worse. And doctors shouldn't be doing it. And I think the state should go after it and say doctors can't do this. So, okay, maybe the feds can't regulate medical practice. States are supposed to, but they should and they better. And it's obvious that that practice is just, it may have religious and cultural roots, I get it, but I don't care. It should stop.
Okay, we have the ultimate ethical dilemma for you that we're going to discuss with our listeners a little bit later in the show, is how much should you spend to keep your pet alive if he or she has a serious... I was stunned, by the way. The average person who owns a pet, according to the story we read, spends $611 a year, which is a huge amount of money per pet for their health and their vaccinations and all that sort of stuff. But a lot of pet surgery is really expensive. So where is the ethical line drawn here, Art Kaplan?
Well, I think he drew it in the piece.
Wow.
He said if you can't afford to send your kid to college.
I know. Well, but most people probably haven't read the piece. So tell us about it.
So I'm going to say 2 points. One, when your pet is really suffering, can't function well, extending their life is cruel. It doesn't do anything for the pet. It does something for you. You're starting to treat your grief by saying, well, I'm going to do the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So it does seem to me, you know when your dog can't walk. You know when your dog can't go outside to go to the bathroom. You know when your dog looks just... or cat, or whatever the pet is, just looks unable to really function, that's it. That's the line. And you shouldn't be spending past that. Then you really have to have those conversations with the vet about, well, what are the chances? Because some of the surgeries, like human, they're going to get you 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks of benefit. But you don't want to spend thousands of dollars for a four-week benefit. I'm not sure I'd want to spend that on me, much less my dog. So we're asking people to make choices. I think there's some guilting.
Oh, God.
That goes on
totally.
Right, by us to each other. You didn't do what? You know, and then your kid says, Dad, how can we not let Fluffy have a month-long stay in the ICU? To which the answer is, you know, some of these interventions just aren't worth it, kiddo. That we're just going to make our cats suffer a long time. So anything that leads to prolonged suffering, time to stop.
I think you let grandma go and save the dog. That's what I...
But here's what is because I've got an old dog now, and here's what's difficult, I think, for a lot of people, is that your dog has ailments because he's old. So they'll say, well, he's got an enlarged heart. Maybe we need to do an electrocardiogram.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking...
You did it, didn't you?
I did do it, and I think it was $400.
Oh, my God.
And I thought, so... At the end of the electrocardiogram, they're either going to tell me his heart is worse or his heart is not worse or it's the same. What am I going to do about that? You know what I mean?
Right. So a good question, Marjorie, is to say, if we run this test, what difference will it make to the treatment? Is it going to make any difference?
Yeah.
Or are we just going to know that he's dying of an enlarged heart as opposed to he's dying? So ask that question. But again... Don't feel guilty if your pet really is miserable, if your pet is suffering. I think that tells you the time has come to stop, and I think good veterinarians will do that. They'll say, I think we've reached a point where we shouldn't do other things. We're just prolonging a miserable quality of life, and that's when you have to make the choice to cut back. By the way, at my old haunts at the University of Pennsylvania, we were doing kidney transplants on cats.
Oh, come on. God. Oh, they have a great vet school there, don't they?
Wait a second. So you're the problem, not the pet owner. Why should you be... Hello?
Well, partly yes. Because we had these capacities that were almost as good as human, and we offered them, and people didn't know what to make of it because they felt like, well, if it's out there and it's a possibility, I guess I should get my cat transplanted. But again, there does seem to me to be some number, I don't know what that number is, but when it's really denting your budget and you are sacrificing other things for the pet, you just have gone way, way, way too far.
I think you've gone too far. Marjorie's younger, after Marjorie did the EKG for the dog, her younger daughter had to move into her car. But but she still has housing, so what is the big deal?
You've got pet insurance, though. That's an alternative to get the
biggest
pet insurance.
Biggest scam. It covers nothing.
Well, this says
I pay $49 a month to cover. Everything I submit is rejected.
It
doesn't matter what it is.
Oh, that makes me feel
for
better because I never got pet insurance. But hold on for 1 second, though, Art, because I know we have to go. But what they'll tell you when you ask about the electric cardiogram, they would tell you that we can change his medicine. That's the reason.
So you do it.
So you think, okay, well, they're going to change his medicine, so I guess I do it. You know what I'm saying?
And then the question is, and if we change his medicine, he'll live how much longer?
Okay.
Well, I'm not sure.
All right. I'm going to play hardball.
And then the answer becomes,
What are you doing on the Everyday Ethics podcast? I'd be doing this if I were you. What are you doing?
So we were going to do this, but I'm going to shift gears because there was an announcement today that in China, a doctor scientist had edited genes in a baby, in an embryo, in an embryo in a dish, to try and confer protection against getting HIV. And this is crazy land because this wasn't approved by any research boards. This guy just went out and did this. He edited, using the new CRISPR techniques, an embryo and basically said to couples who were getting infertility treatment, I can edit your embryos and put some protection. Remember, he's not treating a disease. He's saying, I'm going to protect you against something. I don't think we know enough about CRISPR to be doing that in human embryos yet. This guy didn't get reviewed as to his competency or anything. This is going way, way, way off the far edge of doing irresponsible research. So we'll hear about this today, tomorrow. It's a big deal because the future, if you will, is how far are we going to let people try to alter the genes of our descendants.
By the way, CRISPR is the George – we had George Church on. That's a George Church thing, right? He is unbelievably brilliant and – what a communicator. Hey, Art, it's great to talk to you. Talk to you soon.
Thank you very
pleasure.
Much, Art Kaplan. Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's the Drs. William F. and Virginia Connelly Mitty Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center and the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. So up next, with the New York Times reporting workplace abuses at processing plants that make day of delivery possible, is it time we consumers boycott these conveniences until working conditions improve? We're opening the lines and asking you next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today on Boston Public Radio at noon, it's Cyber Monday, and as much of the world goes to Amazon.com, its employees protest what they call inhuman working conditions. So what to do? We'll ask you.
Then we talk to TV's Bob Thompson about the best and worst TV moments of the week, which include the White House Correspondents' Dinner taking comedy off the menu. And all wrapped up, we look at how Mississippi's racist history is front and center in a runoff between Republican Cindy Hyde-Smith and Democrat Mike Espy, who's vying to become the state's first African-American senator since Reconstruction. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
So, hi, Marjorie. You know, it's Cyber Monday. That's what we're going to talk about. I'm just reading our friend and guy we admire, Andy Barwitz, a great satirist. Mueller offers Cyber Monday plea deals is what is this headline is, in any case, it is Cyber Monday, projected to be the single biggest online shopping day in the U.S. this year. Maybe good news, obviously, for online retailers, but not necessarily for their workers. The New York Times has been reporting on the toll that the demand for instant delivery is taking the people who have to make it happen. On today's edition of Marjorie's favorite podcast, The Daily, New York Times Daily, here's how Tasha Morell describes one of her worst days working at a Verizon warehouse.
Ms. Linda was talking to the supervisor, telling him that she wasn't feeling well that day and she needed to go home. The supervisor stated to her, you can go home with a point, but I'm not going to authorize for you to go home. And 2 to 3 minutes later, Ms. Linda fell. As she fell, she hit her head on the rail. When she hit her head on a rail, she collapsed. She was just laying there on the floor. And the other co-workers got down on their knees and wanted to give her CPR. The supervisor instructed them, no one better not touch her. Leave her alone. Let her be. Do not touch her. And they did not touch her. And she died on that floor. And the supervisor confirmed, yes, she's dead. And they were asking, she's still over there. She was like, yeah, she's still over there on the floor. But people die. Oh, well, people die, but we still got to get this work out. The customer still wants their phones.
Is that chilling? That is just unbelievable. Yeah. And those customers, by the way, happen to be you and me, all of us who shop online and want speedy delivery. This is just one example of the pressures that companies put on their workers to meet growing demands and to stay competitive with Amazon. And with today being what they call it, the Super Bowl of online shopping, we're asking you, is it time for us to stop being complicit? The number is 877-301-8970. And by the way, for those who, I mean, that's an extreme and horrible story. But beyond the Verizon stuff and their, what are their people, women who had miscarriages at one of their warehouses in Memphis, they say, because of working conditions. And Amazon, their workers in the UK were striking the other day, protesting inhuman conditions. We've all read about no breaks to go to the bathroom in a lot of these places, that the 15, we discussed this with you guys, the so-called $15 minimum wage thing that they announced in many ways
sounds
is
good.
Not, in many ways, is a pay decrease
right.
for a lot of low-income workers. We read the Facebook story, and we had the Facebook document. I mean, almost everything that is in major use that today
right.
most of our listeners probably are employing have horrible practices that do horrible things to real people, and we are complicit, aren't we?
Well, it makes it very difficult for us to be holier than thou, Jim, you know, about other things
I know.
That the government may be doing, because we are definitely...
The government may be doing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we were talked about this earlier. You know, I'm a little upset about tear gassing people at the borders.
Oh. You mean when we're doing things or supporting businesses?
Yeah, we are supporting businesses that are also doing terrible things. I mean, this person wrote this piece about, do you have a moral duty to leave Facebook?
Yeah,
and
that.
He pointed out that, you know, Facebook has been used to spread white supremacist propaganda, anti-Semitic messages all around the country and outside the country. You know, the UN.
We saw that in the Frontline documentary.
Yeah.
Where
it blames Facebook for a hate speech that resulted in ethnic cleansing in Myanmar. You know, the Cambridge Analytica, all this kind of stuff. I mean, does the fact that it's spreading all these horrible things around the world, not to mention interfering with elections, does your wanting to send pictures of your children and grandchildren or your neighbors or your vacations and sandals resort overcome?
How many times have you been on Google this morning? 50?
Well, that's another one. I am really
$90
guilty.
$90 million secret
totally
payout
guilty.
To the executive who was engaged in sexual misconduct.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you're supporting that.
I'm supporting.
I don't mean you.
I am
too. We are.
I'm a horrible person, Jim. Let's just face it. I don't go on Facebook much, but I do go on Google all the time.
So do I.
I'm ordering from Amazon all the time.
So am I.
It's just absolutely terrible. And apparently Verizon is implicated.
I'm a Verizon customer.
Yep, well, this XPO factory that The Daily did the story about this morning. Then she meant this one woman who collapsed. There was another woman who also collapsed. And they just put orange cones around mm-hmm. her like it was a traffic accident. And left her there on the floor for hours until somebody came and took her away. They're all working around this dead person lying on the floor. It was unbelievable. So you get Verizon, and this XPO delivers mm-hmm. for other companies as well. So maybe all the companies that you're ordering from this Christmas season, you were contributing – to companies that leave dead people on the floor surrounded by orange cones.
This is why I told you a couple of months ago on the air that I'm starting to make my own clothing. I'm serious. You really can't. I mean, obviously, there's some wonderful exceptions, companies that really do good things by their workers.
Yep.
But we're listing some Verizon, Google, Facebook,
right.
Amazon.
That's right. That's
I mean,
right.
And I would. Is there any chance that anybody listening to the show, this is not just the cover for our own guilt, by the way, is not going to use one, if not all four, of those companies?
It's a pretty feeble excuse when you think about it. You know, give me liberty or give me death. The former patriots of the United States of America are willing to die for their country. The servicemen and women who go and volunteer and sign up willing to die for their country. And we're not willing to give up, you know,
two days
on delivery because we don't want to have to actually get in the car or get in the tea and ride to the store to buy something. We have to order everything online.
So the number is 877-301-8970. So what's your reaction to this? There's nothing we're telling you that you didn't know before. We all know about some of the employment practices of Amazon. I actually didn't know about the Verizon stuff. I knew how they had treated their workers, some of whom were engaged in long strikes, far longer than they needed to be. We all read this Google thing. We talked about it on the air ad nauseum. We were disgusted. It hasn't stopped me from using Google. Now, of course, you can use Bing
all day.
Or whatever the hell
Google
it is,
Chrome.
Ask.com and all this other garbage.
Should we switch to Firefox? Isn't that connected to Google?
I don't know. 877-301-8970. So what do you do in the face of this news? Now, the way that Marjorie, I think I'm right about this, and if this is unfair criticism, tell me. When we read about the child labor in China at the
plant that was producing
the iPhones,
Apple.
The thing that allowed you to continue using Apple products was you did about 3 minutes of research and found out that there were competitors who were treating young kids in horrible fashion in their plants
That's
in China,
right.
too.
That's right.
So your explanation was, as long as every company is exploiting young workers, then there's no other alternative.
Well, think of what you'd have to give up. You'd have to give up your Verizon phone, Jim. Mm-hmm. You'd have to give up Nike sneakers because Nike apparently uses this XPO. They also do other bad things. Mm-hmm. You'd have to give up Amazon. Yeah. You have to give up Facebook. You have to give up going to Whole Foods because now that's owned by
Amazon. Oh, it's owned by Amazon.
No more hot bar for you. Mm-hmm. You have to give up your Apple computer. I guess you'd have to give up your Dell computer. You have to give up
Well, we don't know about Dell. We shouldn't.
Okay. All right. I have not.
Let's not criticize them until we've done a little research.
I should do a little research on Dell to see if they're exploiting child labor in China. And we have to give up Ivanka Trump clothing, as we all know, because she's one of the big exploiters in China.
877-301-8970.
But I believe if you investigate your other phone makers and your other computer operators, they're not exactly, for the most part, pillars of good treatment of their workers.
So what do you do? By the way, there are some things. You don't have to use Amazon.
You just have to give them
you
up.
You do have to use a phone company.
You have to give them up.
No, I'm serious. By the way, what do you do? I mean, it really is totally unprincipled. If you were one of the workers who were being exploited by one of these companies, not even if it's far less serious, you know, no bathroom breaks, which is horrible, by the way. People working for Amazon, stories of them peeing in trash cans because they couldn't get bathroom breaks.
And having multiple miscarriages.
And obviously the most extreme example, this story that woman told so powerful, this Tasha Morell thing we played from the Daily a couple of minutes ago, this Verizon warehouse worker. But what do you do? I mean, do you know people who – I hope people are going to call us – well, lines are full, but I don't know if any of them are there. I hope people are boycotting some of these companies and have found suitable alternatives, you know?
Well, I think there needs to be some kind of organized – boycotting
All right, very good news. You can boycott Dell, too. Because according to the New York Times, in 2007, factories that supplied – this is thanks to our coworkers – more than a dozen corporations, including Walmart, Disney, and Dell, were accused of unfair labor practices, including using child labor, forcing employees to work 16-hour days on fast-moving assembly lines, and paying workers less than statutorily required minimum wage. So you can add Dell to the list, too.
We have to move to the far reaches of Vermont and go off the grid. That's the only answer. But we can't even be safe there because, as we all know, with this terrible climate change report that came out and says that we're going to be like in a total disaster in about 20 years, that all of our meat eating and dairy eating is contributing. So we have to become vegan.
But in a moment of seriousness, just for a second, well, I don't know of any of the phone companies that don't have employment problems. So let's assume for the moment, if you need a cell phone, you can't find an alternative, which is not much of an explanation. Mm-hmm. Amazon, it is not required.
No, it's not.
That we use Amazon
to
purchase products.
No, but everybody does it because it's so
convenient. Are you going to stop today? Am I going to stop today?
Well, it's difficult to stop this time of year because it is Cyber Monday.
No, I'm
and the
serious.
Christmas season.
Think about it
no,
for a minute.
No, I'm confessing. I'm a hypocrite. I'm a bad person. I'm not going to give up on Amazon, at least until January 1st.
Ann in Austin, you're first on Boston Public Radio. You've been on hold for a while. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Excellent.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say I have decided I do not order online at all on Cyber Monday. What I've discovered is you can find great deals in the time leading up to Christmas. So I choose not to do any online.
But what's your motivation, and why do you not do it? Do you do it as a matter of principle because you're disgusted by the employment? What?
It's a matter of principle because I am disgusted by the employment practices.
Good for you.
Particularly of Amazon. And I don't do Walmart. I have to bring my mother there. And I do that because I try not to impose my own feelings on other people, but I have tried very hard to, I actually moved away from Verizon, then found out that the company, the middle company I was using Verizon Towers. So I had to go back to Verizon because I was paying the middleman money to use Verizon service.
You know, so, Ann, you are a role model for us. Thank you. You were a great first call, and thank you for doing it. What do you think of her?
I think that's
why can she do it and you and I can't do it?
Well, there are other people who are emailing that are doing the same things. Well, Jean just says she has a Kindle. I do shop at Whole Foods because it's in my community, but I do not have any apps on my phone. I do not shop Amazon. No Prime membership. It is possible to live without it.
Can I just realize, you know what I said? I told you earlier, and I'm going to mention this a little bit later when Bob Thompson joins us. Do you know what I binge-watched this weekend? Homecoming, which is the Julia Roberts thing. You know what station it's on?
Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime.
That's right.
I mean, really?
Write that down. It's a long list. We have a long list here, Jim. Amazon Prime, that's on my list.
Okay, you don't have to write it down. 877-301.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
By the way, is the
10,
whole
11, 12
daily podcast as haunting as this one?
It's fantastic.
Soundbite?
It's fantastic.
I know it's great every day, but is
yes.
this painful
and she, and
as
the
this?
Woman, the employee talks about the fact that she...
Tasha Morell, this woman?
Yes,
yeah.
Tasha Morell said she did not want to... Her doctor gave her a note and said she should not be lifting heavy equipment after she became pregnant. And they said, you got to keep lifting the heavy equipment. And so she had a miscarriage and many other
this
workers.
This woman had a miscarriage?
Yes, and she had it at 3 months, which is pretty late to have a miscarriage.
Wow.
And many other women in the pregnancy, that is, and many other women, co-workers, had miscarriages. And the Senate is asking about this pregnancy discrimination. Nine senators led by this Blumenthal from Connecticut and our own Elizabeth Warren wrote letters to the chief executives of Verizon, XPO Logistics, mm-hmm. wanting to get information about these terrible conditions at this Memphis warehouse. Memphis is, I think, if not the poorest, one of the poorest cities in the United States
by
of
the
America.
Way,
and she talked about the fact that there were no other jobs, and that's why she was to have
in addition
there.
To the United States Senate, the Massachusetts State Senate is going to take this up as soon as they get back from their five-month vacation. Diane in Attleboro, you are next on Boston Public Radio. What's up, Diane?
Hi, I listen to you guys every day at work, and I'm temporarily laid off for a couple of weeks,
oh.
but I finally get the call. Love your show.
Well, thanks, and we're sorry. Hi, Diane.
I'm 65. Mm-hmm. I use none of it. I don't have a computer. I have what they call a dumb phone. I spent $10 on my phone last year on minutes.
And wait a second. And is this by choice that you're doing this? Or?
It's just the way I live. I just don't choose to do anything like that.
So you're off the grid kind of thing?
Well, I have cable, and my phone's on cable, but I enjoy my cable TV. But I find I live just fine without all that stuff.
Well, I admire the fact that you can do it. Do you feel like your life is less full as a result of it, or what?
Absolutely not.
Okay, I won't be texting you then.
I'm 65. I work two jobs. I was really bummed because I just had to file for Medicare, and I don't feel 65.
Yeah.
But I work two jobs. I work part time in retail, and I don't feel like I'm missing anything.
You don't sound it.
I have a lot of friends. I have a lot of friends. I have a lot of family.
You know, thank you. Thank you for the call.
But that's a healthy woman, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a healthy woman. I mean, I think a lot of us could get by without Facebook. I guess you can go to Instagram. Is there anything terrible about Instagram we should know? I don't know about Instagram or Snapchat.
You know who owns Instagram? Who owns Instagram?
Oh, it's at Facebook now. Yeah. That's right. Mark Zuckerberg owns Facebook. So that takes care of Instagram.
Can I tell you something? Okay, I would say, here's a prediction. Can you write that down, please? Yep. Write down this prediction, too. I would say by July of 2019, Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos will own every single thing in the United States, including the government. I mean, it is unbelievable.
I don't know. I think that
2 billion users.
I think that the patience is wearing thin.
What's the evidence of that?
I think the Democrats are going to start regulating.
Yeah, but he's willing. They'll do. No, it'll be some sort of thing on the margins, which will allow them to say that they're doing. They're not messing with Mark Zuckerberg. They're just not. Robert in Burlington. I don't think.
I think they will.
You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
They don't like him.
Hey.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. And before I make my comment, last week I binge watched Homecoming. It was a pretty stunning little series.
Isn't she great in that? By the way, Julia Roberts.
Julia Roberts is just—it's so good to see her back in something.
We have to put her off the list though, because she's in an Amazon Prime.
Sissy Spacek is in that too, by the way.
Oh my goodness,
is her mother. But I'm glad you liked her. What are you calling about today?
Well, as far as Amazon goes, and I am a user, but when a couple of weeks ago, when I heard the big decision about going to 2 economically thriving areas with their headquarters, I was really, really disgusted and. I've actually been thinking about boycotting them. And in some cases, I'm going to, the websites of some of the providers. Like, you know, I happen to buy Mizuno sneakers. Mm-hmm. I used to get them through Amazon. Now I'm on the Mizuno website, and I'm doing just fine. But Amazon, I was disgusted. I was hoping they were going to pick, like, a Baltimore or Detroit.
Yeah, that's a really insightful point, by the way, Robert, that they could have totally rejuvenated communities with tired local economies. That's a very, very important point. I hope you don't find out that Mizuno has killed any of its workers, Robert. But it's good. Now, there's a creative guy, and thank you for the call. There's a guy who's creative. He used to buy Mizuno. Is that the right word? I never heard of him before. Mizuno sneakers from Amazon, and now he's decided to go directly to the source. And by the way, almost everything you find on Amazon,
you can find elsewhere.
Or you can go use Amazon, find out what the product is, and then go to the company's website and pray that the company hasn't abused its workers.
You have to make sure that they're not involved with XPO, because they're a delivery service Amazon. And they were the ones that were doing.
Well, you can just drive to Minnesota, pick up your sneakers. I mean, it is true. You know, in all seriousness, it is virtually impossible.
Well, it's not impossible. We just don't want to give up the convenience, and I'm guilty as charged.
What are you going to do about Google, by the way?
What the hell am I going to do about
Google?
I spend all day long on my computer.
One of our computers upstairs, my computer in the newsroom, not here, for some reason, the default search engine was ask.com.
Oh, yeah.
Where you
or
cannot
Yahoo?
Find. There is nothing you can find. You type in anything in ask.com, and you get nothing. I mean, Google is thousands of times better.
That is correct.
And considering what we do for a living, even if we didn't do this for a living, it's pretty critical. But $90 million and failure to be transparent to an executive who left not because he was moving on to better things, but because he was a sexual assaulter.
That's right. Make $90 million on the way out the door.
So does that give you pause?
Claw it back, by the
does
way?
That I don't think so.
Oh yes,
obviously it doesn't give you pause. So what do you mean? Oh yes, oh yes. As she's googling something as we speak. What do you mean? Oh yes.
I think that's the dilemma. What am I going to do? Go on
ask.com.
I'm going to go Yahoo. Yeah. Yahoo's the other one. They're not very good.
You know, when you search on ask.com, you know what usually comes up? Call a friend. That's what it says.
No, that's not what it says, Jim. It says ask Google. That's what it says. By the way, one of our coworkers, Arjun, he went to Amazon Books in Palo Alto this weekend.
Oh, that's where he's from. He's out there.
They've completely gotten rid of the bookstore employee, so you can walk in and buy a book on your phone and walk out.
Well, you know, didn't Amazon start these food stores where there are no employees either? The couple of brick and mortar little food things where you...
I don't know. They're going to have little robots at the hot bar soon, Jim.
I mean, it's a real
serious... I bump into somebody.
Somebody on Sunday at the hot bar and somebody Friday on the hot bar. And you know what both people said to me? This is so pathetic. It's true. I thought Marjorie was kidding when she says all you do is spend time
is
at the hot bar.
It's amazing how many people I meet somewhere say, oh, I met your buddy Jim. I say, oh, where'd you meet him? They say, at the hot bar.
I can't do that anymore either, by the way.
All over the place.
What am I supposed to do? Go to Wegmans?
You were in hot bars. Were you in the hot bar in Hyannis when you were down
there? I was. When I was there, I had a speech on Friday, one of the Fridays I was off. And I went right from the speech to the hot bar. That's a nice Whole Foods down there.
It's a very nice Whole Foods.
Yes, you've spent time there.
I have. Nancy in New Hampshire, what do you think?
Hey.
Hi. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Thank you very much, Nancy.
I actually gave up Amazon Prime a year ago after Parkland.
Wow.
Because we did not want to support a company that had NRA TV on it. And it's been hard, but you can order your stuff directly. Like, we did a lot of pet food and things like that, so now I go to Chewy.com.
I use Chewy.com. I like them.
Right.
She's my daughter.
And then, you know, you can go to your local independent bookstore. They really appreciate it. My son is 31. He orders his whole life on Amazon, but I can't control that.
Right.
But we don't support the Salvation Army because of their anti-gay rhetoric.
Well, also, the Salvation Army here was also years ago really, really bad, and some efforts by their employees to unionize. Nancy, can I get back to your original thought here? NRA TV was running on Amazon Prime. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, on Amazon.
Did they dump them? Do I recall correctly?
I think there was a petition to get them to judge. I'm trying to look this up.
Can you guys
Google,
check this out
course,
in the control room if you don't mind?
And there's been many requests. Tech giants Apple, Google, and Amazon should use their power to dump the NRA. This was a saying,
Nancy,
after Parkland, that they wanted these companies to go after them. But
so
there's
Nancy,
no indication they did.
Ease of life should not be more important than principle. But is your life dramatically less easy because you make these individual purchases and things, or no?
No, it's really not. You just have to plan it and support your local small businesses more.
Nancy, another woman who sounds totally calm and healthy,
you know,
mentally healthy, I should
NRA
say. Nancy,
TV,
thanks. We're really glad you got through.
Chan, remember we looked at it?
I do.
After
I do
Parkland,
remember. Yeah.
And it's really
good for her, by the
something.
Way. By the way, if that's true, and we're going to, I'm not questioning Nancy, but we're going to confirm this with our coworkers in a minute. How can you and I, who've railed against the NRA, continue to patronize a company that is, that if it did have this NRA connect? I mean, how do you do that? I mean, how do you justify that?
You justify it not very well by saying, well, it's a busy season, Christmas time, and you're going to have to go to the mall to buy everything. Instead, you can just shop from home. It's not a very good excuse.
You know, when Nancy just called about the NRA thing, Marjorie was checking it out, and she went on Ask.com to do it. And when she clicked submit, Ask.com laughed at her. Did you see that?
No, I went right to Google Chrome, and all the stories popped right up. I mean, that is kind of the problem, isn't it?
So you go on Google Chrome, which pays its executives tens of millions of dollars, a payout, after a serious sexual misconduct, to search whether Amazon, which you're going to probably use later today on Cyber Monday.
What about Twitter?
What?
Has Twitter got any problems?
I don't know, horrible things.
Should we look to see what
By the way, can I tell you one of the few principal things I've done?
You went from Uber
I don't
to
use
Lyft.
Uber anymore. I use Lyft.
But that wasn't that
after
big of
the
a
Uber,
deal.
It was horrible.
Because there's
Travis,
another option.
What?
There's another option.
There is another option.
Well, I think that's the thing. If there were another option besides Amazon, but they have a monopoly, and that's one of the difficulties
they
in
do
having
have a de facto monopolies, monopoly.
And that's
it's
why
true.
I think they're going to get regulated because they're
Amazon now. Amazon's going to be regulated too now.
I think that the honeymoon of the Democrats.
Well, you're talking about Facebook
Silicon
a few
Valley
minutes ago.
Is over. Yeah. I mean, there was a great
Amazon owns the Washington Post, which I would argue is the single most important newspaper to a significant chunk of people in Congress. And by the way, Marty Baron has said, to his credit, former editor of the Boston Globe, not to his credit, but to the credit of Bezos, Marty Baron, the former editor of the Globe, who is now the editor of the Washington Post, has said Bezos has been a totally hands-off
but supportive owner. Well, are you suggesting that Bezos is going to use his newspaper to go after people that try to regulate
him? I'd worry about it.
Well, I think
Marty Baron would allow
Marty Baron would resign immediately and say he's resigning and humiliate Jeff Bezos, and then it would be difficult unless he's just going to go pull a full Hungary or something, or one of these other countries that is totally lost their freedom of the press. Anyway, let's
By the way, Arjun has been checking. This is not definitive, but has so far as can't find anything about Amazon or Google dropping NRA
I think they were asked, and they have not done it yet. That's my understanding.
We have time for one more.
Okay, Allie in the car. Hi, Allie.
Hi there. So I guess I'm going to hell. I use Amazon everything all of the time, and now I feel terrible about it.
Me too.
I do have a new, I use the Amazon Prime Whole Foods delivery. I just did it yesterday. We get Amazon packages. I don't want to say daily, but we definitely get Amazon packages frequently throughout the week. So I feel a little bit guilty, but I've been recently trying to use Target, which is probably not any better. But if you have their red card, I use the free shipping. So,
well, Allie, the only good news out of this phone conversation is I'll meet you in hell. So
I'll be right there.
We'll get
with
to
you.
Talk and hang out. I'll buy you a cup of
what?
I have a quick question for you guys. I sent you guys a video of my son saying your names on the smug mug. Did you guys ever get that video?
Oh. If we did, we met. Can you please, will you send it again?
Did you send it to BPR?
Yes.
WGBH?
I will, yes.
If you send it today, we get a lot of emails, which is no apology, which is no excuse. We'll make sure we look for it, Allie. Allie, can you do me a favor? Stay on hold. Tell people what your email address is so people know to look out for it.
But I have one more comment real quickly. I've been wanting to call for the last 2 years.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys remember, but I was about to deliver my baby right at near the election.
And I totally do. And
I had my baby the night of the election, pretty much when Hillary was conceding at 1:45 in the morning on November 9th.
But the kid's healthy, right?
What's that?
The kid's healthy, yes.
Oh, yes. My son is great. And I just had my other baby about 2 months ago.
Oh, so. Congratulations. At least you had the baby to cheer you up when Donald Trump became the president.
Well, that's a hell of a night to have a kid. Allie, congratulations. Thanks for calling us again.
You didn't name the baby Donald Jr. or anything, did you, Allie?
She didn't. Stay on hold. Don't go away. Actually, I said it was last call, but we should get this one, too, because this is actually a positive development. Lauren in Cambridge, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Lauren.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yep.
I just thought I would share with you that I was literally sitting at my desk on Amazon shopping, and I had been waiting all week, and I knew all the things I wanted to get. And honestly, listening to the show just kind of was the last straw for me. And I just said, you know what? I can do this. I can stop shopping on Amazon. I live in Cambridge. I can go outside. I can figure this out. Nobody needs something so badly that I have to contribute to something. And it just seemed like a very doable thing. And I just thought you should know that, you know, it turned me around and I'm going to figure it out differently this year.
So, Marjorie, if Lauren changed her behavior because of our conversation, is it not incumbent on us that we change
Lauren
our behavior?
Is a better person
Lauren,
than I am.
You are
I don't
terrific.
Want to go to the
Thank
Cambridge
you.
Side Galleria.
Remember in the old days, the Cambridge Side Galleria, they called us in when we were working on the commercial radio station. We used to mention that if you went to the Cambridge Side Galleria, this is many years ago, you should go armed because there were a lot of shootings. And the people who owned the gallery were really upset with us, so they called our boss. And we had to go on a tour. And we went on a tour, and we assumed that we were going to get a lot of free stuff. There weren't any shootings. That was the good news, but there wasn't any free stuff either. And we really.
What killed me about the Cambridge Side Galleria is you have to pay to park. After you just go in there
inside
and bought a television set for $300, whatever, at the Best Buy, or you went to the Gap or whatever you did, then you had to come out and like
pay $5. No, but the plus, you're being totally unfair because you said that to the owner of the mall.
Did.
This is years ago, but when Marjorie complained about the parking fee, they say if you pay the parking fee, you're given possession of a weapon for 2 hours to defend yourself inside the mall. So, by the way, that is the old days. They've really cleaned it up.
It's
fab.
Right. They've changed it up.
Everything's great.
No one's getting mugged on the escalators like they used to. I mean, it was always a question. If you were coming up the escalator, would the person that was coming down attack you with your shopping
bags?
Here's
I know we don't have time, but I got to tell the story because I haven't told this in a few years. When my daughters were really young, they're like 4 and 6 or 2 years apart. I'll never forget. I'm going on the escalator at the Cambridge. Again, this is years ago. They're now 24 and 26. I'm at the Cambridge Side Galleria, and we're on the escalator with a couple of teenagers who are it's not fair to say every other word was an F-bomb. I think it's fair to say that every word was an F-bomb. So I politely turn to these teenagers in front of my 4 and 6-year-old daughters and say, hey, guys, do me a favor. Just want, you know, young kids. I got young kids. You can just hold it for a couple of seconds. They both turn to me and go, F you. So that was those are the old days, though. They don't do that anymore at the Cambridge Side.
Well,
as far as I know,
as far as you know.
Totally
okay.
Different now.
Up next, our TV man, Bob Thompson, joins us to remember an...
Oh, she does.
I do.
You're right.
I do.
Okay, good.
He's going to be here to remember an intergalactic, interracial kiss that made television history. Bob Thompson next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And the White House Correspondents' Dinner is taking comedy off the menu. Instead of a comedian cracking jokes at the president and press's expense, historian Ron Chernow will be holding forth talking about the First Amendment. Is this an example of the press taking itself too seriously? Is this the kind of reboot the dinner needs? Or does it even matter if the stereotype is true that only a few C-SPAN junkies and us, of course, tune in? Joining us to talk about this and other TV news is Bob Thompson. Bob's professor and founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hey there, Bob.
Hi. Hope you both had a nice holiday.
And
oh,
you.
We had a great holiday. Thank you very much for asking, Bob. I hope you did, too.
I did.
So could this be your best? I know we've talked to you a lot about comedy at this White House Correspondents' Dinner. You weren't a big fan of the last go-around, I don't think.
I have not been a fan of the whole, you know, these kissing up between the people who are covering people and the people who are being covered. You've heard me rail about this White House Correspondents' Dinner. So even though an awful lot of people have been saying the press has bowed to Trump's call to change the format and all the rest of it, nevertheless, I am calling this my best in that I just don't think what that White House Correspondents' Dinner did was a healthy thing. It was, remember we talked before, it was about giving scholarships, and they would cut away from that to do the red carpet while they were actually giving the scholarships. If this thing turned into a staid, every year, some Pulitzer Prize winning historian or somebody, an expert on something else, actually talked about journalism, and then they actually gave out the scholarships, I think that's a good thing. And it's not as though we don't have plenty of people exercising their right to do comedy about politics, because there's, about 200 of those shows out there.
Well, I have to say, I love the comedy. We had Ron Chernow in here a couple of months ago. Obviously, he wrote Hamilton, I assume.
I know.
People know the book and about some presidential biographies, too. And the guy's pretty amusing. I mean, he's not exactly, Stephen Colbert. But, nobody is going to watch this thing now. I mean, does that concern you, or is that not really relevant?
Well, it is true that the comedians brought people to the not only it used to be just C-SPAN covered, then it started getting covered by the 24-hour cable networks that weren't C-SPAN as well, and that was because of the comedians. But they watched it, but it became completely comedian based. And that was not necessarily a bad thing. I think Michelle Wolf and Larry Wilmore and lots of others who have done that. Colbert, of course, did a famous White House Correspondents' Dinner way back in the day. I think those were, they were funny. They were great to have big audiences at. I just have to go back to the idea of the venue. They used to call this, the journalist's prom. And this idea of having, the people they cover and the people who do the covering kind of having this party. I always thought that journalists and the people they cover ought not to be friends.
By the way, Trump said he may go now because they're doing an historian.
Well, he did say that, yes.
Just one thing, because we have a great little let's play the sound first, and I'll ask you the question. This is a montage of various correspondents, dinner monologues, starting with Michelle Wolf in 2018. We've also got Stephen Colbert in 2006 and Hasan Minhaj in 2017.
Good evening. Good evening. Here we are, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Like a porn star says when she's about to have sex with a Trump, let's get this over with.
The White House has personnel changes. And then you write, they're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. First of all, that is a terrible metaphor. This administration is not sinking. This administration is soaring. If anything, they are rearranging the deck chairs on the Hindenburg.
You gotta address the elephant that's not in the room. The leader of our country is not here. And that's because he lives in Moscow. It is a very long flight. It'd be hard for Vlad to make it. Vlad can't just make it on a Saturday. It's a Saturday. They're also was another elephant in the room, but Donald Trump Jr. shot it and cut off its tail.
Okay, I guess the question is, why do we care if anybody watches this? I mean, does it matter? And they may watch it anyway because of the stars that some reporters invite to the table, just get the red carpet thing going. But it doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, comedy, good political comedy, is an important part of the political conversation, the civic conversation. And I think we have had some really good political comedy in this country since the turn of the century, when it really started kicking up. So I think those little comic lectures, performances, whatever, are in fact important things for people to hear. Again, I'm talking about the venue. And by the way, they talk about this as the centuries-old tradition. We've had comedies doing the White House Correspondents' Dinner since 2004. But in 2003, Ray Charles hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner. In 1999, Aretha Franklin hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So we've had comics for for a while, but it's not as though this is that time-honored a tradition.
But the biggest
I bet you wish you were at 1975's White House.
Who's that? You?
Danny Thomas and Marlo Thomas.
Oh my God.
You know, that had to have been good.
But by the way, I'm sure there was some coffee spit takes, by the way. But putting that aside for a second, the saddest part is I think with Ron Chernow, we're not going to get to see Don Lemon drunk out of his mind at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which really sad. In any case,
yeah,
Bob.
Yeah, maybe I should rethink my designation
I think you should.
Of worst in that case.
Okay, so what is worst this week?
Well, this is kind of a mean one. But
oh, good.
Starting the day after Thanksgiving, mostly Lifetime Channel and Hallmark, but a few others are getting into them, are going to be bringing us, and have already started bringing us, over 60 of these holiday-themed Christmas romantic movies. Including the day after Thanksgiving, the Hallmark Channel graced us with Pride, Prejudice, and Mistletoe. And I just have to tell you, the original Pride, Prejudice without the mistletoe was way better.
Okay.
There's also a very nutty Christmas. A bakery owner encounters a hunk in her living room who may or may not be the Nutcracker Prince. That, by the way, was written by one of my colleagues, so maybe that'll be good.
Who wrote it?
Shoe Addict Christmas.
Shoe Addict?
That's the name of one of these things.
By the way, we have a clip from one of them. This is a Lifetime Christmas movie. It's called Jingle Bell, as in B-E-L-L-E. Here it is.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
You know that song I'm supposed to write for the Christmas concert? Guess who's directing it?
Michael?
Bell?
They didn't tell you either.
Probably because they knew I'd say no.
It was a bad breakup. Here we
gather. I gotta tell you, writing this song with Bell, it's really giving us a chance to connect.
When you let your guard down, that's when you create something great.
There's no place like home.
Do you know who's singing that song, Marjorie? Ron Chernow. Do you... It's a little change of pace.
So Bob, sometimes there's I can't expect you to watch all 60 of these, needless to say. But sometimes there are some good Christmas debuts. I mean, Jim and I, even though our staff makes fun of us, are big fans of Love Actually. That's been around
for
20 years.
Who doesn't? Half our staff doesn't like it.
But I mean, you know what I mean? There's these breakthrough ones.
And I am a big fan of holiday-themed programming. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is still one of my favorite things ever made. So I have nothing against Christmas programming. And when you're talking shows like Love Actually or A Christmas Story or It's a Wonderful Life or a whole list, those were theatrically released things. These things are churned out. 60-plus of them in between Thanksgiving and Christmas Day. And I will also say, even though they get my worst, they are completely competently done. If you like movies like A Shoe Addict's Christmas, which, by the way, It's a Wonderful Life. No Love Actually. It's no Charlie Brown Returns.
Okay.
But if you like that kind of thing, and a lot of people do, I should also point out that these things do incredibly well for Hallmark. Just like December is the great month for retailers, December is a really important month for Hallmark and Lifetime, for that matter.
By the way, before we leave this, you used to watch Hannah and Her Sisters with your family every single Thanksgiving because of the Woody Allen thing. So what did you watch for Thanksgiving this year?
We binge-watched 8 hours of Broadchurch.
Oh, you did? Oh, great. Oh, great. I mean, I binge-watched Homecoming. I watched the whole series. You recommended Homecoming. Did you not recommend Homecoming?
I did.
I loved it. Julia Roberts is fabulous in that, by the way. She's just great. In any case, so there are a lot of 50-year anniversary things. One 50-year anniversary thing I'm pretty sure we haven't discussed on this show. 1968, correct me if I'm wrong, the first interracial kiss on television on Star Trek. Am I right?
This was November 22nd, so 50 years ago this Thanksgiving. Well, it wasn't the first interracial kiss, though you are, when you call it that, you're with most other people, because mm-hmm. that's what it's generally called. There were at least two kisses between white and Asian characters prior to that, one on I Spy, as a matter of fact. And, in fact, Sammy Davis Jr. gives Nancy Sinatra a little peck on the cheek. It's not a big romantic kiss, but he does kiss her a year before this Star Trek wow. thing. So we've got to qualify it. This is generally considered the first interracial kiss, and it is really a kiss. And it was 50 years ago, Thanksgiving 1968, between two of the regulars, Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura, and of course Shatner as Kirk.
What was the reaction?
Yeah,
at the time?
Exactly.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, what was the reaction, Bob?
What was the reaction?
The public reaction to this, to the Star Trek.
It was not, there was a, when the Petula Clark special played, and Harry Belafonte took her hand in the course of singing a song, just took her by the arm, one of the advertising executive went nuts. Mm. This Star Trek thing did not, It was not the big deal, I suppose, that many people might have expected it to be.
By the way, Loving versus Virginia was just the year before. It was 1967,
that's right.
Supreme Court decision.
I know.
Right.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
It is amazing.
Yeah, we forget how
recent.
How very recent, yes,
yeah.
this kind of thing is.
So, Bob Thompson, tell us about this Mystery Science Theater 3000 at 30. What's going on?
Well, this sounds like the worst idea in the world, but you point out, it's been going 30 years. It started on a Minneapolis television station back in 88. It's been on Comedy Central from 89 to about 96. Then it went to the Sci-Fi Network for a couple more years. And now it's just started its second season on Netflix. They started it again 2017. Its basic premise is about this guy and two robots who watch really bad movies, and we see them from behind, so we can see the movie and their profiles, or whatever you call them, from the back of their heads, and they make snarky comments throughout, and then there are occasional sketches scattered in between. By the way, Beavis and Butthead, a few years later, would do the same thing with music videos over on MTV. They'd show music videos, and the two of them would make their stupid comments. Mystery Science Theater started out in the very early days of Comedy Central, actually when it was still called the Comedy Channel. And it didn't get really high ratings, but it got a cult following. And then when the internet came along, people started picking up on it. And it really is something that's managed to take movies that would be otherwise unwatchable and turn them into something completely different. One of the original notions of repurposing.
Okay, let's play a little clip from the trailer for the new season of Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Ladies and gentlemen, of the world stage, prepare to witness the most mind-bending act of movie ripping ever attempted.
I present to you The Gauntlet.
The Gauntlet?
Six terrible movies ripped one after the other.
Can Jonah Heston, his robot jerks, and you at home survive six horrible movies back to back? We can't rip six movies in a row. Our brains will melt.
Our souls will implode.
You know, for those who haven't heard, this is a real cult thing. I've only seen a few of them, but it's sort of like high-tech Wayne's World to me kind of thing. And I think the guy, whatever his name is borderline genius. I think it's great, great fun stuff, Bob.
Yeah, you're not alone. I mean, a lot of people, and when you think of the concept, this idea of taking bad material and using it as a palette to make something good is kind of a sophisticated idea.
Robots are really funny, too. For people who haven't seen it, Google it, and the robots, their interaction with a human is pretty funny.
So, Bob Thompson, this is an interesting story about novelists now being kind of enthusiastic, I guess, about writing for long-form television. I didn't realize all these people, Margaret Atwood, Gillian Flynn, Salman Rushdie, Tom Perata, that they had all written for television already, and that David Simon, who gave us The Wire, wrote kind of crime novels before he did that.
Right. And now I think we're paying attention because the New York Times did this piece about how the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, which is, of course, a real mecca for people who want to be novelists, has now gotten around to offering a writing for television class, which in some ways is hardly stop the presses kind of news. There are many universities across the country that have been offering writing for television classes since television started. And for that matter, there have been a number of novelists. Gore Vidal wrote for television, actually before he was a novelist, way back in the 1950s. If we count movies, both Faulkner and Scott Fitzgerald wrote for movies. Not very well, but they wrote for movies as well. I think one of the reasons we're seeing this melding now is that television has become so novelistic. These, classy, high pedigree, 13-part per season shows allows you to tell a story. You know, we didn't have serialization in TV. We had it in radio and soap operas from the beginning, but we didn't have it on primetime television for the most part until Dallas in the late 1970s. Peyton Place did it for a bit, but that was kind of a flash in the pan. So the idea now that television, most television is not episodic, it's serialized. So the skills of a novelist and the skills of a television writer have merged. And now that we've got this fancy television, you don't have to be, you know, appealing to 30 million people. You also don't have those kinds of limitations either.
By the way, I should correct myself. David Simon, the guy from The Wire, he wasn't a novelist. He wrote nonfiction stuff. He used to be a Baltimore Sun reporter.
Right, but they were very novelistic nonfiction.
Yes.
You know, I know this is, we're talking about novelists writing for TV, but you know who is a really interesting example of people writing for movies? Ben Mezrich has been with us a bunch of times.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And he lives a couple of blocks from our library studio. And he says, I love the candor on this because so many writers are, well, at least pretend they're a little more pure than this. He's told us that every chapter he writes in a new book, he sends the chapter out to Hollywood. He doesn't even wait for the book to be done, meaning he is totally conscious of how what he's writing will look as a movie. And I'm guessing there are a lot of these novelists who are now doing TV who are doing similar sorts of things. Obviously, there's a lot of money in it.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. There is an awful lot of money. And I'm of two minds about that story you just told me, because as much as I think there is overlapping and a person who can write a good novel can also write a good film, there are certainly novels that I dearly love that I am really glad weren't written with the screen in mind. And I think you're right. And almost any contemporary novel we pick up today has got a certain cinematic or televisual quality to it. And imagine if Hollywood and TV had been around when Melville wrote Moby Dick. That would have been a very different kind of book, because that book is not adaptable unless you only do the whale parts.
We just did Moby Dick as our book club thing, the
and
radio book club.
We're going to read after the new year. We're going to read
in
New Bedford. Yes, we are.
At the Moby Dick-a-thon or whatever it's called, 24 hours of Moby Dick reading.
I have probably read Moby Dick from cover to cover 25 times in my
You're
life.
You're kidding. Wow, that's great. Wow.
That book has everything in it, and every time you read it, you find more stuff that you didn't notice before.
I love hearing that. So what are we watching this week, Bob Thompson?
Conan O'Brien is doing his 10. Yes, he's still on the air. He never gets talked about. He seems to have been completely left off the list when everybody talks about what's going on in late night. But he does this kind of ongoing series during his own time slot called Conan Without Borders. And he's going to Japan on Wednesday. Well, he's been there, but they're showing it on Wednesday. And I think tonight they're going to rerun his Haiti episode, tomorrow his Italy episode, and then Wednesday will be his Japan episode. And I think it's the 10th. He's been to Israel and Cuba and all over the place. And I think he does his best work on these overseas things. We've talked about them before.
But I don't know if we talked about the Israel one. It is one of the cleverest, funniest bits I've seen. It's really great. By the way, he's 30 minutes now, right? Is that the new iteration of Conan O'Brien, down from an hour to 30 minutes? Is that the deal?
That was the plan. You know, I don't know if that started yet. This will be an hour long.
You know what?
These Without Borders are an hour.
Speaking of hour long.
The plan was to move Cohn down to 30, and I don't know if that was going to be this coming year or if that's already happened.
For the, this is not a TV thing, but he's also got a podcast now called Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. And I listened to the first one with Will Ferrell, and it is really
great. Listen to a podcast?
Well, only because I knew we were talking about Conan O'Brien,
wow.
And I heard about it, and I hadn't listened to it.
He's still a brilliant comedian. You know, you're right. He's got he's brilliant in that podcast. He was one of the first geniuses of using Twitter way back in the day.
And for the three people listening who do not know, he's from Brookline,
He's from Brookline High School
Brookline
graduate.
Brookline boy, that's right.
That's right.
Hey, Bob, great to talk to you.
You too.
Thank you very much, Bob Thompson. Bob Thompson joins us.
See, wait, before you continue, you love Broadchurch, right? Because
I did.
I'd been recommending. I think
I
Bob loved it, too. It's great, isn't it?
I did. I'm not liking the second season as much as I like the first season.
And by the way, you should watch Homecoming. That's what I binge-watched. Homecoming, which Bob recommended ages ago,
you know,
which is a 10-parter, but they're 30 minutes each with Julia Roberts.
Yeah, you know what?
What?
This is a real sickness, this binge-watching.
How great is it, though?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
If you don't like it, you don't watch a second 3 one.
3 o'clock in the morning.
You don't have to be.
Well, it was hard to tear yourself away because you need to find who the killer is.
Julia Roberts.
Right, you do. And they don't tell you until the last like 5 minutes.
It's amazing how they do that,
of the eighth episode,
so
and it's 3 o'clock in the morning.
Sorry.
Okay,
about
Bob
that.
Thompson joins us every week. He's the founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Up next, Michelle Obama hits the Boys and Girls Club of Dorchester before her mega book event at the TD Garden. Irene Monroe was there. That and more is next and all revved up with Irene Monroe and Emmett Price, our reverends. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about the moral dilemmas of the day are Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. They join us every Monday for All Revved Up. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, Boston voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail, and a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU School of Theology. Emmett is professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Irene and Emmett, great to see you.
Thanks for having us back.
And glad to be here.
Okay, Irene.
Bearing
you were
photographs.
You were at the TD Garden seeing former First Lady Michelle Obama talk about her new book. You just showed us a million
pictures.
Yeah. You're grinning from ear to ear.
I am. Absolutely. I was gifted front row seat tickets.
What?
Front row.
That's right. Front row.
And didn't
seat.
Take any of us.
Wait a minute. No. My spouse and I, seats number 7 and 8.
Wow.
7 and 8.
Wow.
Absolutely. It was phenomenal. It was Michelle, how do we pronounce it? Norris.
Yeah.
Former
of NPR.
Yeah, of NPR was there. And it was a wonderful evening as she talked about hope, empowerment, and healing. And it was so wonderful to see mothers and daughters in tow carrying her book.
We don't care about Michelle Obama. We care. How'd you get the free tickets? That's what we want to know.
It was gifted. And, you know, the interesting thing is the seats were just prohibitive. Like $3,000 for the full packet.
You know what's amazing?
Was it mostly women?
No, you had a fair number. No,
fair
no.
number of men.
You know, the interesting thing is, this is the thought. I thought Thea and I really were going to be in a bowl of milk.
Yeah.
But actually, we weren't. There were a fair number, a lot of black folks in front rows, all throughout the theater, children, men. It was wonderful. It was really, I need to say, it was the Obama coalition that came out.
So what's going on? First of all, Josh Miller, who's a really good political reporter, wrote this story, and it's unlike any story I've ever seen Josh write. He uses his words, adjectives like rock star, thunderous, joyful, spellbound.
That's right.
I've never seen it like that. What's the agenda here? I don't mean this like she's got some nefarious thing going on, but she wrote a book, obviously, by the way, which is selling more than former first ladies.
That's
books,
right.
Like Hillary Clinton and others like that. But what's the end game here?
Well, she is spectacular. And I think that's the challenge that folks, you know, folks slept on the fact that she was the first lady.
That's right.
People didn't know how brilliant she was, that she actually could have been the president, that she had the brains, the brilliance, you know, and the brawn to be who she is now. And so now it's her
that's
time.
Right.
It's her time.
But also what she's doing is reintroducing herself.
But her time for what? Because, for what?
Well, she's reintroducing herself.
And to be?
Well, it's not so much to be.
She's
but
young.
It's to becoming.
She doesn't have
it's
to
more than to be
anything,
it's becoming.
Jen.
And that's a very important concept for women. The whole idea, and one of the things she talked about was this concept of swerve, meaning, and what it means is that we need not to be flexible about our life trajectory, of this whole notion of, you know, these check boxes that we have and stuff. But what she says about that is that it's really an empowering statement, that when we follow our bliss, when we work towards empowerment and healing, we don't have the kind of society that we now are living in. And the interesting thing about her message, you heard men in the audience, you know, rooting as well for her. But the thing is that she had to reintroduce herself. Now, let us just go back to the campaign trail, 2008. Remember when she was in the Wisconsin primary? She was so excited and very candid about how, you know,
first time I've ever been proud of my country.
That's
is that
right. That's right.
From?
And then let's remember the New Yorker 2000 cover where
terrorists.
She's got this this Angela Davis.
Right.
So she's trying to move away from the trope of the angry black woman, and also for you to see her as who she is.
Okay, but let me try a third time.
Okay.
She is young.
Yeah.
She and her husband have, to use a double negative, never done nothing.
Yeah.
That's
I mean,
right.
They're both activists. They're both.
Yeah.
So what is the next? She said emphatically she's not running for president. I think if she was running for president,
she'd be a really serious contender for the Democratic nomination
and to beat Trump.
But she gets
so
to tell her story.
Going?
She gets to tell
that's
her story
right.
now, not their story, but her story from her perspective, through her lens, through her experiences, and not necessarily overshadowed by, you know, Barack Hussein Obama, who was the president. Right?
Even though he showed up at her Chicago
event. Well,
yeah.
That's the
that?
Fun, though. Yeah. He's the plus one now,
that's
right?
Right. That's right.
That's
but
point.
She did say this, though. One of the thing, complaints, not complaints, but one of the points in the book is that here she is, equally highly ambitious, but only seen through and recognized through the lens of her husband. So, I mean that in many ways is empowering, because many of us who are married are seen by our high-powered, you know, spouses.
I love this story.
Well,
by the way, the one line, if I can just say this, the one line in Josh Miller's story, before Barack, and that's obviously she's calling him Barack, came to the law firm where she worked, Michelle saw a bad photograph of him and thought he was, quote, going to be a nerd. He's going to have
yes, that's right.
like a pocket protector. He's going to be all serious. I love that.
But she says this to the audience on Saturday. She heard this baritone voice and she said, but maybe I need to think again. But
on the phone, right? But
Marjorie, you would appreciate this. Girlfriend came out in this silk navy blue outfit. Wait a minute. With these silver stilettos, hair flawless, and listen to this. She had this ring. It was iridescent. Talk about bling blinging. Okay, it blinged the rainbow, depending on what angle
you're
you stared at it.
You're superficial as Marjorie
wait,
is.
Wait,
it's a beautiful
a ring,
thing.
Like on her
diamonds.
Like, wedding ring finger?
Yes,
or
she did. I mean, not one, but a whole bunch of them. Okay?
Really?
I mean, it was
maybe
blinding.
Maybe I think of those big book advances. He bought her a big diamond ring.
It was blinding.
No,
it was another light, with all these big book advances.
But you know what I thought was, and I haven't read the book yet, but I've read excerpts from it.
Yeah.
Is that she told a lot of real stuff.
Intimate stuff.
Yeah, like about having infertility problems and test tube, they wouldn't call them in test tube babies.
IVF, right. Right.
In vitro and fertilization.
And the
all
birth
that.
Of conspiracy.
Yeah.
And how that not only affect her, but really in terms of impacting her children. And what you don't know, what she shares in the audience, is the number of attacks against them not recorded. Not recorded, and they're and going after their children.
Okay.
So I think that's important.
So everybody
but she
knows her.
Oh my God!
Very few people knew Olivia Hooker, who died at 103. Emmett, tell us her story if you would.
Well, I mean, here is an absolute legend. She, let's see, how do you say this? She was part of a moment where we had what we call Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tulsa, Oklahoma had a thriving metropolis, thriving downtown that was all black. Black capitalism, black consumerism, black
at its
economy.
At its best.
And at a certain point in time, there were riots in 1921 where a lot of racist individuals came in and plummeted to the area. Mm-hmm. And she is one of the last surviving people who was there, who saw it. Olivia Hooker, 103 years old, just passed away.
And by the way, as many as 100 to 200 or 300 people killed.
That's right. And it started with the usual racist trope that a black man had raped a white woman.
Right.
And so what happened was is that once the news got around in town, a number of blacks went to the police station trying to ward off the possibility of this gentleman being lynched. And what happened is that many of the cops, part of the police force to serve the peace or protect the peace, were also engaged in this, you know, the Greenwood fire. The thing, there's a legend also who was a child at the time that this happened, John Hope Franklin.
That's right.
He is from Oklahoma, and he talks about that time and the tremendous fear. But I think what we got to understand about Oklahoma, there was another kind of plundering and pilfering of another minority group, and it's a book written about it. It's called The Killers of the Flower Moon, the Osage Murders.
Oh, yeah.
And what happened was that they had this is the time of when they relocated them to what they thought was a wasteland, and find out that on top of this wasteland is oil. So this is that too is one of those events that we need reparations for.
One of the traumas of this is that this narrative has never made it into the history books. So when people think about a thriving black metropolis or a historic moment of black history, people think of Harlem.
That's right. They think
of, you know, the Harlem Renaissance or the Negro Renaissance of Harlem. But at the same time, in Oklahoma, of all places, there was this thriving metropolis, a center of commerce, you know, black business, black lawyers, black doctors, you know, of high caliber, who have been forgotten in the annals of history,
and out of racial animus, just wanted to just and literally decimated and leveled the area. It was just unbelievable.
I heard her speaking, obviously, before she died on the radio, remembering this, and she sounded very elderly when she was talking about it. And she said she remembered seeing the men with torches storming into her family's backyard, her mother shoving her and her three siblings under the dining room table, going to find the longest tablecloth she could to cover the children, told them not to say a word, and these guys with the torches came into the house, took an axe to the family piano, and then left. But they destroyed her father's business.
They destroyed her father's business, but what it didn't destroy was her resilient spirit.
She
went on to have a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and a doctorate degree.
And psychology.
And
was a professor.
The first black woman in the Coast Guard,
That's right.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah,
I think from 63 to 85, she was on the faculty at Fordham.
But there has been a movement that I hope that will come, will be reparations. And they're arguing within the same context of Japanese Americans who were interned and stuff. The money that was lost, the emotional duress, all of that, we're hoping at some point to see some form of
reparations. By the way, we had George Takei Takei is how you pronounce his last name, who did that brilliant play
Allegiance.
About his experience.
That's right, Allegiance.
In the internment camp. Did you see it?
Oh, absolutely. I wrote about it. Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I went
to see what you
wrote. At the speakeasy. Yeah, absolutely.
In any case, we're talking to Emmett Price and Irene Monroe.
I just want to say I'm on good behavior because
Why?
Emmett's parents are here.
They are? I wouldn't call this good behavior. Comparatively speaking,
I'm trying my best. I even promised them that I was going to be on my best behavior.
Okay, so she's letting Emmett get an extra word.
You know what they're probably saying to each other? If this is her best behavior, exactly.
So the Washington Post has a piece, the headline of which is, "What's with all the racist uncles?" And they're wondering why we never talk about the racist parents, racist siblings, racist brothers and sisters in the holiday discussions. You're looking at me oddly.
Well, because I thought that was a very interesting kind of article for Emmett and I to read. Number one is that that seems like a conversation that maybe you and Jim and others should talk about. But we don't have racist uncles. We got some crazy uncles, okay, for sure.
But they're in the attic.
There you go. But the idea of us talking about racist, that seems like a disconnect.
No, but I don't agree with you, because at least from my quick read of this piece, by the way,
but you got a crazy black uncle?
No, I don't. Not that I know. But Sandra Newman writes, racist parents are nowhere to be seen in these fables, nor racist brothers and sisters. In the happy world of the racist uncle, bigots stop reproducing in the 1960s and survive only in the form of childless middle-aged males who go to their siblings' houses for the holidays. It's in part about denial. Her piece is about denial on the part of white people that we have racists in our families close to us. It's always that distant, crazy uncle kind of guy, which obviously is not true.
So the Thanksgiving table has become a very important place of gratitude
hotbed of politics.
And so, you know, those kind of conversations move outside to the front yard, to the backyard, to the back of the kitchen,
cave.
You know, to the cave, you know, but away from the
actual table,
you know.
Right,
and so I think that's the other cultural challenge, I think, as well. So, I think some folks have these very hard line, you know, business oriented conversations at the Thanksgiving table, and others really just
look at the smile on it. Sorry, Marjorie and I will have this conversation alone.
Yeah.
And then next week we'll revisit.
I don't want to get into what many white folks do. I don't want to do blacksplaining for white racist relatives, okay, and stuff. But if you have one, you know, I mean, that is a good conversation piece. And if any of you got black racists, I'd just like to meet them.
Well, I think there was a lot of debate before Thanksgiving, and this is obviously talking about white families.
Yeah.
That if should you confront your racist
who
uncle?
Wrote the piece we talked about last week, who said you have a moral obligation to confront racism
shouldn't be trying to keep peace at the Thanksgiving Day table, because what kind of example are you setting for your children if someone says something racist about the caravan, for example?
The problem is the Thanksgiving table is not the place to have that kind of public conversation.
But some families
do. Because those conversations need to be held one-on-one so that you're not showing out for the crowd.
Okay. What do you do for your children if they're hearing racist uncles say...
You pull them aside. And they already know that something's a little off by that person anyway, because that's not the ethic and the moral that you teach in your household.
Yeah.
So there's something out of alignment. But you pull them aside and you suggest that this is going on, and then you pull that uncle aside and say, in our household, we don't talk like that.
But Emmett, there are some folks, some families do not have table etiquette. And that when one uncle or someone say something, because they're sitting down and it's already a tinderbox, and they say something and it becomes explosive, and the dinner is just shot to hell.
Well, that's Irene.
Really
when you shift, I don't have family, so I don't have to show up. But you get this. Remember, at most homes, there are two tables, right?
Absolutely, the children.
And that's when you shift that adult from the big table to the little table, and you send them there.
I don't feel like I'm in the place to tell white people how they should deal with their racism. I can only tell in terms of their family. I do say this, like when I said that there was 53% of the women who voted for Trump, that this is indeed, and then there, I have some, you know, white friends that will say, you know, well, you know, I didn't vote for him. And I keep saying, but you got racist relatives. This is a family affair. I don't know how you folks do family. So that's my point, is that I think that's a conversation that you folks, I don't always feel that you confront a racist, you know, face to face all the time. Sometimes it's better just let, some people I just feel you can't change, just let it be.
I wonder if at the Thanksgiving table in Mississippi, if Cindy Hyde Smith's relatives confronted her. Well, I want to talk about Pope Watch because we only have a minute left. We talked about Cindy Hyde Smith earlier. Cardinal O'Malley was left off the organizing committee for this abuse prevention summit. And this is the summit in February that theoretically was why the Pope or the Vatican ordered the American bishops, who in my opinion were cowards and really let down their flock, were about to do something dramatic, they say. I would like to have seen it, on the abuse prevention and transparency front, and then stopped because the Vatican told them to. Your former, was he your boss at Crux, John, what's his name?
He was not my boss.
What was he?
He was just another reporter.
What's his last name, Alan?
Alan, John.
Okay, he wrote a piece in the Globe, basically, in my opinion, twisting himself into a pretzel, saying, the fact that O'Malley was left off this is not that big a deal. He'll still have a major focus. The Pope's not a dope, it seems to me. This is a pretty strong message to O'Malley. And if you agree, what is the message, Irene?
Okay, that he needed to speak up when he had the opportunity to do so and didn't, and then to push it to, I didn't get it because my secretary or it fell through the system.
The letter about McCarrick and the letter about another priest who was abusive.
Particularly, he was supposed to be the man. He was like the man. He was the no-holds-barred man that was going to stamp out and address this issue.
Do you buy that, Emmett?
I would say it differently, but yes.
Really? Yeah. So you're basically saying the Pope, who is not exactly painted himself with stars. I don't know what that expression is.
I never agree with the Pope, but this time I do.
But so he did the right thing here, even though he hasn't done the right thing himself.
Well, maybe he's mad at O'Malley for humiliating him before the world over Chile is seeking revenge.
So you think it's the opposite.
So it's not about righteousness. It's not about righteousness, is it?
I don't know.
If it were, we wouldn't have the problem we do.
By the way, can I tell you that I have Helen Drinan on TV with me tonight, who's the president of Simmons College, who wrote an incredibly courageous piece about a cover-up when she was at Caritas Christi, and talks about what the church should reform itself, and about the role that Cardinal O'Malley played in that unfortunate episode. So again, President Helen Drinan. As opposed to other nights.
Okay, exactly. That's right. I'll watch you tonight.
Emmett, Irene, it's great to see you both. Hi to your parents. Okay.
Thanks so much. Appreciate
you
guys.
So we're not sure who talked more there, Irene or Emmett.
I think we're sure.
We can pull the metrics.
I apologize to the prices.
We can pull the metrics.
Not Emmett, but to Emmett's family.
Okay.
His parents.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, you guys. Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us every week for All Revved Up. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail, a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at Boston University School of Theology. Emmett Price is a professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Coming up, Charlie Sennett joins us to go over Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Brexit, etc. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Marjorie. Now that Theresa May's Brexit deal has the backing of EU leaders, what happens next? Join us to talk about this, chaos at the border and the slow-motion fallout from Trump's denial about Saudi Arabia, and more. He's a news analyst at GBH. Charlie Sennett is. He also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Charlie Sennett, good to talk to you.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Hey, Charlie Sennett. So Angela Merkel calls this, she's a German chancellor, of course, calls this deal a diplomatic piece of art. The Labour Party in Britain says they are going to reject it. So what's the deal with this agreement that Theresa May has hammered out?
Well, look, there's been a lot of comparisons between what's going on between the UK and the EU to a divorce settlement. And that is absolutely the way to look at it. And divorce settlements are always difficult. You have to bring both sides together at the table. Right now, Theresa May has successfully sold a middle-of-the-road plan to the European Union. They're willing to accept her terms for walking out of this deal. Really historic move if it happens. But her own party, conservatives in her own party at least, are saying not so fast. We don't like this deal. The Labour Party to the left of her is saying we don't like it either. And there's going to be just a real battle royale inside of Parliament this week over the next few days as they try to hammer this out. So many, many steps to go before any of this really can be considered a done deal. So Parliament has to vote, and then it's kind of up for grabs. If Parliament rejects it, it could go back to the people for a vote. It could be modified in Parliament. They then have to go back to the EU, and the EU is saying they're not going to change any core elements of the deal. So we've got unbelievable political theater about to unfold in London.
You know, every week we discuss this with you, I say, why don't they just do another vote? And now somebody is on my side. Tony Blair, the former prime minister, was on BBC a couple of days ago. And here's what Blair had. Blair, who at one time was referred to as lovingly as Bush's poodle over there in the UK during the Iraq war. Here is Blair.
The issue for the Brexit people is precisely the reason why we should go back and put it to the people for a final vote. Because the very people who agitated most strongly for Brexit are now saying, this isn't Brexit. And therefore, literally, why are we doing it? We're not doing it to satisfy them, and it obviously doesn't satisfy people like me.
So set the odds. What are the odds about there being another vote? Does Parliament have to reject it for that to happen?
Tough one. And as you know, I am a terrible gambler. But I think it's still a long shot. And here's why. Procedurally, I think it's a long shot. A second referendum, if there is one, would give the citizens of the United Kingdom a chance to change their minds, to stay in the European Union. But it has to be passed through Parliament. So that could take many, many months to set up, and they have this March deadline looming. And I don't know. I wonder about sort of the timing and the logistics, and I think time could just simply run out on that option. So all of this is to be determined. It really is just an unbelievable. The odds on the horses in this race are too close to call. I think it's going to come down to Theresa May. You know, is going to have to step up and sell this to her party and get it through. And it is the greatest challenge of her life. It is a historical moment inside of Parliament. And actually, if you kind of look at her track record, she's a tough negotiator. She's very capable and has the skills to navigate this. And if she fails, there is political hell to pay. She is likely to lose her position as prime minister. There will likely be a recall vote. Parliament her party will turn against her, and that will be very ugly.
We're talking to Charlie Sennett.
So, Charlie, Hillary Clinton was over in Europe saying that they have to curb immigration to stop right-wing populists, and she's quoted as saying after her loss to Donald Trump, where immigration was a big deal, that the use of immigrants as a political device and a symbol of government gone wrong is also an attack to many people's minds on their heritage, their identity, their national unity. And it gets exploited, and so you have the rise of populism. I mean, she's got a point, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. I mean, where was she on making that sort of happen, though, within her own party or as part of her own campaign strategy? I never saw any really enlightened policies on immigration reform coming from Hillary, but she certainly put her finger on it now, as has Blair and the former Italian Prime Minister Renzi. These are three left-leaning former heads of state being interviewed by The Guardian, a left-wing newspaper. Really interesting to hear each of them taking the time to say this is a very, very big issue right now, and that immigration is going to have to take a front and center seat on us. The rise of the right is going to have to continue to happen.
Well, you know, I think the thing with Hillary Clinton when she was running, that if anybody was concerned about immigration, then right away they were labeled a racist. And I think that that's not necessarily true in every case. I mean, you could argue that maybe if we had little blonde kids coming over the wall
Norwegians.
In Mexico, we wouldn't have tear gas. But, I mean, I've always thought there was legitimate fear among people about losing jobs to people who can undercut them wage-wise. And it's happened in the trades, obviously, here, and I'm sure it happens in Europe as well.
Well, it's hard to say, right? Because there's definitely an element of reality to this, that this is putting a strain on limited resources at a time when the global economy is shifting and very much in a tumult and people are afraid. And I think one of the big things that comes out of Hillary's message in this interview with The Guardian was that fear sells. So you need to get ahead of that fear, and you need to legislate sensible immigration reform so that you can bring the fear level down. Otherwise, the far-right parties across Europe will continue to exploit that. And I think we face the same issue in America. We're the failure of the Democratic leadership to have any kind of real vision for what immigration reform will look like, or to be more precise, to get it through Congress, right? And you can argue they've been blocked by a Republican-controlled Congress. Well, all that's about to change, and there will be unbelievable pressure on Democrats in our own country and on liberal governments across Europe to find immigration reform that makes sense, because it's a real issue. People are afraid for their futures, and the purpose of government leadership is to answer to people's needs, to calm their fears, and to move forward. And I don't see any of those three leaders who were interviewed by The Guardian on this ever having parties that saw that as a vision. So it's kind of interesting to watch them point a finger now that it's burst to the surface like a boil on the skin of Europe as populism and as nationalism.
Well, it's like Jeff Flake saying to the outgoing Arizona senator, saying to 60 Minutes, "Oh, I couldn't say what I was saying if I was running for office," meaning I can now tell the truth now that I am a candidate.
Term
you know,
limits.
Speaking of Congress, it appears that our president's decision that justice is less important than jobs in terms of the murder of Khashoggi is causing some Senate Republicans, who are generally mute when it comes to standing up to the president, to maybe confront him and say that the United States does have to take action against the Saudis. Is that unrealistically optimistic?
No, I absolutely think that the White House is misreading the Khashoggi murder. I think when we're at a moment in our nation's history when Turkey's prime minister or foreign minister is lecturing to us about the morality of the moment we live in and telling us that the United States is this immoral state that cares more about money than human rights. When it's Turkey lecturing us like that, we're really in trouble, because Turkey doesn't have a good record on human rights. They're one of the worst jailers of journalists in the world. And for them to be standing up as this sort of moral compass in the middle of this story that, of course, just to remind your listeners, all unfolded in Istanbul, unfolded with the Turkish government leaking the information out that really pointed the finger and then began to build into a consensus that this reached the highest levels of the House of Saud and was a planned hit, an execution of a great independent journalist who, while a Saudi citizen, was working for the Washington Post and a resident of the United States. That's a big story. That's not going away. If Trump continues to be an apologist for Putin, a human rights violator, for Kim Jong-un in North Korea, a human rights violator, and now for Saudi Arabia and for the House of Saud, whether or not it's the Crown Prince specifically, just the House of Saud in general is good enough. That's a real issue. I think people in America don't like that. I think they're miscalculating. I think this story has a lot of legs, as we say.
Well, you know, in addition to this, the terrible murder, there's also this side of the story, which is getting a little bit more play anyway, is the deaths in Yemen. 85,000 children at least may have died of starvation. Save the Children says that number is very low, and the United States is supplying a lot of the weapons to the Saudis that are enabling them to wage this war against Yemen. I guess we've given them $566 million in aid, but you know, isn't that another big problem? I mean,
yeah, I mean, that's at the
children?
Core of this is totally. I mean, the Trump administration's calculus that we need Saudi Arabia because they buy a lot of our weapons, which create a lot of jobs, it's a pretty cold calculation. I mean, I know that he's a transactional politician, but that's cold calculus to say that weapons sales are more important than the humanitarian tragedy and atrocities that are unfolding in Yemen, which are being caused by the weapons we sell to Saudi Arabia, which is driving this war in Yemen. It is really, I don't think, the spirit of American values. You know, you might say America's always carried itself with a veneer of caring about human rights. You might say, you know, that it's almost a conceit that we say that. But when you begin to even strip away any perception that we care about these values, when you go right to the crass core of saying, hey, we care more about the arms deals than these children who are starving or these civilians who are being bombed, that gets us to a place in our country that I don't think Americans are comfortable with. It's not how we see our country. It's not who we want to be. And if we lose all aspiration to be a better country, I just don't think that that's going to wash. And okay, we might be saying that from the liberal bubble of Boston, or right now I am in the swamp. I'm in D.C. I could be misreading it. But, you know, I've been traveling in the country a lot in the last year with Report for America in West Virginia and Kentucky and Ohio, in the South. I don't know. I think this crass sort of transactional politics in the world, whether it's with Khashoggi or it's with Kim Jong-un in North Korea or it's with Putin, I think it's got like an hourglass. I think it's got a time on it, and I think it's running out.
You know, Charlie, we only have a minute, speaking of time running out, but I didn't know you were in Washington. But since you're in Washington, we talked earlier today about the Black Friday release of the government climate report, talking about the impact over the years on the economy, on the Midwest. I mean, it's all disastrous. Again, this is the government report, the government that is run by Donald Trump. Does it change anything in Washington, or is this just another thing that gets filed away, like, I don't know, like the New York Times report on tax fraud in the Trump family?
I don't know. I'm not sure. But I'll tell you, it certainly reveals the cynicism of an administration that its own research shows climate change is real. It's expensive. And it's probably the greatest threat to our security we have in the world today, if you think of it in the long term. And if we have that kind of science coming out of even a White House that wants to deny or deflate or minimize the mounting scientific evidence on climate change, at a minimum, we expose the cynicism of that. And I think, again, you know, I'm like naively optimistic about the American people and about what they believe in. But I just think you can't fool all the people all the time.
Yeah. Well, I think it's not just one of the things I think was so upsetting to people about the climate change, at least to me, was that it wasn't just the East Coast and the West Coast and the wildfires and the hurricanes.
This is pre-wildfires, by the most recent wildfires,
this
report.
It's the great farmlands of the United
States.
Yeah, the what do we call the great farmlands of the United States of America, the plains that feed the world, that they are in serious jeopardy for feeding the world and the United States of America if they have these persistent droughts and high temperatures and stuff like that. It was really, really scary, and also about migration.
Absolutely.
That people are going to be, we think we've got a migrant problem now, then, you know, just wait a few years and everyone will have to, not everyone, but millions of people will have to flee because they'll be starving to death.
Well,
in
like
their
they're
homes.
Doing right now as we speak. Charlie, it's good to talk to you. Enjoy the swamp.
Great.
And we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks. I'll see you next week.
Charlie Sennett joins us every week. He's a news analyst here at WGBH, where he also heads the Ground Truth Project. Up next, this is a burning issue, Jim.
It actually is a burning issue. It affects almost everybody listening.
Are you willing to pony up for your pet? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And according to the St. Leo, I don't know what this is, but St. Leo Polling Institute, pet owners will spend an average of about $237 on their pets during the holidays this year. That's what we're willing to spend on their stocking stuffers. You can imagine what we're willing to spend when it comes to saving their lives. In a 2014 annual spending report, the spending on vet care was $15 billion in the United States. Since then, the amount we spend has only gone up. Earlier in the show, we were talking to medical ethicist Art Kaplan about how much is too much to spend on your pet. His rule in a piece he is quoted in is, if you're blowing your retirement or kids' college fund, it's not funny. Why am I laughing? To extend the life of your pet, that's when you've gone too far. So we're going to ask you, we'll open the lines and say, what is too far for you? Is this a hard decision to make because our pets are like family for most people? Or is your perspective, is as much as you love them, they're just animals? What is your attitude? How far is too far? We don't mean a dollar figure unless you've established one, but how do you decide? With all due respect to Art, it's one thing to say when you're asked for a quote in an article, well, here's the line in the sand kind of thing. But when you're confronted with the issue, what did you just say? You spent $400 to have an EKG for your dog?
My dog, my 10-pound dog.
$400.
I haven't had an EKG. My dog's had one.
877-301. 800-516-8970. Where do you draw the line? Do you decide in advance what the line is in terms of your pet's health care, or do you decide you'll do whatever you got to do because your pet is part of your family? And I would argue, mm-hmm. I mean, we've had this discussion off and on in other contexts through the years on the radio here, Marjorie. A lot of people feel a lot closer to their pets than they do to their spouses.
Given the choice, I think 90% of Americans would say, keep the pet, ditch the spouse. I mean, I think that's a sad reality, but it's true. Maybe after a few years into the
So if you thought of this, your dog is getting really old.
My dog is getting really old.
And he's not in perfect health.
You know what I have? I have one of those pill containers from CVS giving him AM pills Sunday,
Monday,
Tuesday.
Yeah.
Well, that's reason. So many damn
medicines. But that's just the loving owner taking care of their pet.
But, you know, it's true. A lot of people, especially if you have Labrador Retrievers, I mean, that eat anything. I know so many people who, yes. I've had so many people, oh, yeah. You know, you leave everything on the counter like your Thanksgiving turkey. Gone. Yeah. You have to put it 6 feet above so the dog can't get it. But they've eaten, you know, in one case, the husband's underpants. They ate those. They thought the dog had a tumor. They had to operate to get the underpants.
You know somebody whose dog ate the underpants?
I do. You know them too. I'll tell you after the show. Yeah, somebody else's dog, the remote control, they ate the remote control.
That's not true.
Yes. Labradors are famous for eating anything.
These are all Labradors that did this?
Yes. I'm sure other dogs do it, but labs are very popular dogs and they're not very smart. And a lot of people's labs
not very smart.
No, they eat a lot of stuff. So you have to get, if the dog is 3 years old and he ate, you know, dad's underpants. Are you going to let the dog die?
Can
or are you going to do
something?
An operation?
If you smeared a little gravy on it, I'd eat a TV remote. 877-301-8970. It's a real dilemma.
Right? Now, on the other hand, if your dog is like 12, then maybe you're not going to.
Well, your dog's like 15.
He's 16 almost. So almost 16.
So what do you, I don't mean to. Like prying into your personal relationship with your dog
for the EKG.
So if
how to do it?
Well, I'm not even going to put you to the test. It's a horrible dilemma to be put in. What do people do? You know, my older daughter bought a dog.
That's right.
And
You'll be there soon.
I bought health insurance for the dog. Yeah. And as I think I said to you when Art was with us, it pays for nothing. I mean, I have submitted like every bill. Every one of them has come back that there's a clause in the original thing. It's like, but it gives you a sense of comfort.
Yeah, supposedly they pay for surgery. Supposedly they do pay for surgery. I mean, sometimes you're at the vet and the vet will say, well, your dog has a mass in its liver. And you don't know if that's cancer or if that's just a mass.
So what do you do? You have to have a biopsy or something? What do you do?
I'm saying, so why am I going to have a biopsy? Because I'm not going to operate. On my
Art, who is critical of this, said that when he was at Penn, he's now at NYU. When he was at Penn,
kidney transplants
in cats.
Yeah, you know, remember the guy we knew that spent $6,000 on the goldfish?
Well, I think I told this story. I'm not going to tell it again. This is true. We thought it was BS.
No, it's true.
We read it in the paper. I think it was $3,000, but he spent whatever it was thousands of dollars in Worcester at the veterinary hospital there on eye surgery for his goldfish. And not only did we think that was untrue until he called us on the phone, do you remember? But we met the goldfish in Munson, Massachusetts years later because our friend, I think his name was Michael, his house was blown down by the tornado.
That's
do you remember
right.
when we went to
the
visit Western
survived.
Mass?
The goldfish with the $6,000 eye.
$3,000, whatever.
I thought it was $6,000.
Whatever it is.
You know, Bina has a good question. What if your pet is your only family?
Whatever you got to spend.
Paul, on the other hand, said his first dog cost him $35 plus food, vet visit, et cetera. My second dog cost me $800 plus $4,000 for each one of her knee operations and thousands more for cancer.
Well, how do you say, I haven't confronted this. How do you say when your dog is old and a huge part of your family, how do you say, oh, it's $900? That's too much. So really? Instead,
well, they have a
I'm going to go on a go to the Cape next summer. I mean, how do you decide to do that?
Well, they say that this survey by Kroger Company, I'm not sure who they are, but they said that 61% of pet owners say they were comfortable spending $100 to $1,000 to save their pet.
Oh, yeah, I saw this too. Yeah.
15% said $1,000 to $3,000, while 10% would spend even more than that.
Yeah, but that's an abstract thing. You don't know until you're confronted with the issue. I bet you every one of those people would spend more than they say they would when confronted with the problem.
They interviewed this woman in a vet's waiting room where you see a lot of sad stories in the vet's waiting room. And she said, this one woman said she had her cat radiated, had a tumor, and the radiation cost $2,000. She put it on a credit card, and the cat lived for 2 more years.
Oh, that's worth it.
But she said the emotional distress of other pet owners in the waiting room was heartbreaking to watch. The doctor would come out, be clear about the costs, and then the people would be shell-shocked because they couldn't afford.
Oh, that is heartbreaking.
They couldn't
that is horrible.
Well, I mean, if somebody comes out and says it's going to cost you $4,000 to have a liver operation for your dog.
Or 400, the EKG. A lot of people can't afford the 400 you spend on the EKG. You're lucky enough
that
you can.
That's why people max out their credit cards. Yeah. They put these things in their credit cards.
Okay, can we take some calls?
Okay, we'll take some calls.
These are going to be depressing. Why are we talking about this? John and Gardner.
This is your idea.
John and Gardner, you're next on Boston Public Radio. How are you, John?
Hey, kids, I'm well. How y'all doing?
We're good.
Good.
I've spent a few bucks. I grew up in, you may or may not recall, I grew up in a big family.
No, we do. We know.
The dogs came and went. We always had dogs. We had two cats that were always there. They were the mainstays. So mm-hmm. I love both. The way life is, I inherited, adopted from a tenant, a cat, maybe 20 years ago, yeah. Cat number one. You know how some people say haughtily, that's A-U-G-H, haughtily?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I have a rescue animal.
Yes, that's big in Brookline.
Cat number two is a rescue animal because he was left behind in the neighborhood. Somebody moved, as best I can surmise, and he was out on his own. So that was some years ago, and he's my with me now.
So did you have to confront health bills for these cats?
Excuse me?
Did you have to confront the big health bills for these cats?
The last 3 days of my cat number one's life cost me $800.
Wow.
He had I have no life. It was one of the few, I was away for a vacation and I had a friend cat sitting him and mm-hmm. she didn't bring him to the vet. He had this big hole in the side of his head. They called it an abscess. I got home on a Saturday. I had to drive out by Greenfield to an emergency hospital because the one around here wasn't open. That cost me $300 or $400. But at any rate, they started treating my cat out at this place, and we thought he was going to do better, but then it was clear that he wasn't. So the next day, I took him home and then took him for the one-way ride the next day.
Yeah, but you didn't make that decision because of money. You made the decision out of kindness to the cat because it was clear it wasn't going to be cured,
one-way
right?
Ride. Yeah, but prior to that, I spent $800.
Exactly.
And I got a question for other callers. Am I still on?
Yeah. Yes.
The dental work for cats and dogs, obviously they got to put them under anesthesia.
Right.
I had it done once
for
each cat. But I'm wondering if it's a ripoff because that costs about $500.
Oh, my God.
Well, I want you to know, John, my kid's dog, we've had implants for all the dogs because he's looking much better. John, thank you for the call.
I had dental work on
my dog. Yeah, I've had dental work on our young dog, too.
And I was stunned. I got to the vet.
It's very expensive.
And he had to have his teeth pulled because they were getting decayed because he was little. $1,000.
Really?
$1,000.
Well, I guess you have to.
They already pulled the teeth. What am I going to do? So I'm not going
to
pay.
Well, even if not, what if they had said to you in advance, it's $1,000 to pull the teeth and his health's going to, you'd pay the $1,000,
right? Because you figure they'd have a toothache like you, so I wouldn't want him to be uncomfortable.
Oh, my God.
Robert says he and his dog have agreed, they agreed this years ago that they wouldn't exchange any Christmas presents because it takes the pressure.
One of our horrible producers says, do they repo your dog if you don't pay? That's a really good question because they don't make you pay in advance, do they? Where they not let you take the dog home if you don't pay the bill?
I guess they figured I was good for the money and they'd let me go and I paid with the credit card when I got back.
Let's go to Debbie.
Now, here's a dilemma.
Debbie,
is a dilemma.
What is it?
From Art. He says he paid full price out of pocket for insulin to give his diabetic dog an extra 2 years. He never figured out how much it costs. But before that, and here's the dilemma. His dog gave me almost 11 years of hard work retrieving ducks and chasing pheasants to go hunting, and as long as she was comfortable, I figured I owed her very hard to let her go, and that's absolutely true.
Look at what Jason, one of our producers, typed on the board. Can you read that, please?
That they're debating how much they'd pony up to keep me in gym going. That's right. It's got to come
I think
to
more
that.
On the cat.
It's got to come to that pretty soon. That's what I think about my dog now. My dog is really old. I think it's a preview of my future, where I'm going to be. Home in my diapers. You know, it's
Debbie,
a sad state of affairs.
In Chestnut Hill, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. Long
Hi,
time,
Debbie.
First time.
Thank you.
I had to call on this one because I actually had to take a loan out of my 401k for my last dog.
Oh, no.
I love you for it, but go ahead.
How much was the bill?
$10,000.
Oh, for what?
She had lymphoma B-cell cancer, and first she had a hip surgery, and it wouldn't heal. They couldn't figure out why. And believe it or not, it was the emergency room nurse at the veterinarian mm-hmm. that figured out that Princess had a temperature. And when it was all said and done after the biopsy, it turned out she had lymphoma B-cell cancer. And it was a weird way that they caught it, but because they caught it early enough through this aggressive treatment at NEVOG, which is in Waltham, and I can't say enough wonderful things about that place. specialist for oncology. So she ended up living 4 fantastic years, which is truly amazing. She had 1 remission. It was very short, and we treated it, and she had a great life. And when she was ready to go, it was like on an early morning one day, I just knew. But it was that quick.
Debbie, I love that this is your first call. Don't go away. How much did you debate whether or not you should take the 10 grand out of your 401k, or was it a no-brainer for you?
You know what, Jim? For this, it was a no-brainer. She was my 3rd dog in my lifetime, and I had other dogs that had illnesses. But this dog was so incredibly special that it truly was a no-brainer.
Well, you know, Debbie, as you know, while we love Art Kaplan, Art Kaplan's advice in the piece he's quoted in earlier is if you have to, you are exactly the person who he says shouldn't have done it, but I am totally with you. If you love the dog and it's a huge part of your life, you go for it. Debbie, that was a great first call.
Okay, we have
do
a
one
wide
again soon, please.
Range
I love
on,
her.
On the emails.
Didn't you love that story? That was a beautiful story.
It's a great story. Well, a lot of people are saying that they've spent. Listen to this. This is from Maggie. She said she had an English lab named Hambone. Both knees replaced, eye removed, all his lower teeth removed, lots of dental work, thousands of dollars for regular maintenance. And she says he was worth every penny. On the other hand, we have Connor who says, I have no doubt in my mind that my dog would pull the plug on me, so I don't feel so bad. So
Debbie, the one who took the $10,000 loan out of her 401k, just texted us. She said she has to work till she's 97, dude.
Robert
that's
says,
a lot of money. I mean, good for her.
Robert says when things get bad with his dog, when he gets the bills, he just drives his dog to the emergency room and pushes him out the car. The car
this
door
is horrible.
At the entrance to the emergency room.
So we have people. What's his name?
That's Robert.
On one hand, we have Debbie. On the other hand, we have Robert. Beth and Ken, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wouldn't have been so compelled to call had I not, at this moment, been driving back from the Bottle and Can Redemption Center to make $30 to pay a bill. And a large part of that is because my 1.5-year-old Pomeranian has so far cost us $15,000. He was diagnosed with lymphoma, which is very unusual at that age. They couldn't believe it. At Foster Animal Hospital, who are wonderful. But I wanted to also to call because they prepared us from the very first visit. He had radiation for 2 years and all kinds of different chemos and stuff. And the doctor from the very first visit prepared us that we can treat him. He won't suffer while we treat him. He won't live long. He may make it through the treatment. The dog is still alive, and they cannot believe it. I think that they think it's a miracle. He's 4 years old, and he's showing no signs of cancer. And it's just an unbelievable. They literally cannot believe that the dog is still alive.
You and Debbie are going to heaven. Let me tell you, Beth.
But hold on, Beth. $15,000.
Heaven is selfish. I couldn't live without this dog.
Oops. Oh, Beth.
Say that again.
Oh no, I'm sorry. We lost you. And by the way, for those who repeat what you said, you're serious. You're just driving back from the can place where you redeemed $30 worth. I mean, you're unbelievable.
So how many cans is it going to take you, Beth, to get to $15,000?
Well, it's 20 for a dollar.
Yeah.
300,000 cans.
I have to rob a bank.
Drink.
You have to rob a bank.
Beth, but you're a good one. You and I mean, this. You are a good person,
you know, it's
Debbie.
Tough.
Beth, thank you.
It's very tough when they're young. Jeez. If something happens when they're young.
$15,000?
Yeah. That's a lot
$15,000.
When they're older, it's easier.
And does it sound like she had any regrets at all, by the way?
This is another thing that has totally changed.
What's that?
You know, I don't think we ever did this in the 70s or 80s. I don't think so. I think the dog just died, and that was it. You know, you see all these people. I mean, I have good friends that had a lab that clearly was on its last legs. Mm. Not even on its last legs. They had to put him in a sling to take him outside.
Oh,
you know, cause
God.
Because a lot of dogs
horrible.
Lose their last leg. That's why it's good my dog is little. I can pick him up. But the husband and wife were debating. You know, the wife is saying, we got to let him go. We got to let him go. We got to put him down. And the husband saying, no. And they're, you know, spending all this money at the vet. And even the vet is telling them he's not going to make it.
Well, you know, that's where I'm totally with Art. I don't agree with – I'm with Debbie and Beth on you got to spend what you got to spend kind of thing. I'm not giving any advice, by the way. I'm just saying that that's where I am too. But the one place where I'm totally with Art Kaplan is when you are selfishly, for you, prolonging the life of a pet whose quality of life is clearly dramatically diminished, if not horrible, then it's like a sadistic act on your part. You can't, if the dog can't even walk to go outside to go to the bathroom, would you not agree it's time to pull the plug?
I know. Well, I would, but I think it's very difficult for people.
They have to change. Put it down is a horrible expression, by the way. I mean, euthanization is, I mean, there's got to be better language. That's part of the reason people are so resistant.
Kill them.
Well, kill them is, you're talking a big game, Marjorie. But I mean, you're the biggest pushover.
I'm a big pushover. I absolutely love my dog. Everybody loves their dog. I mean, Brian McGroy, editor of the Boston Globe,
beautiful book about his dog.
Yes, how he met the love of his life.
What is it? My daughter, the rooster, Buddy. How a rooster made me a family man. Yeah,
because he had the vet come to his house to euthanize the dog.
Charlie, was that the dog's name, if I remember correctly?
I don't remember the dog's name. Yeah. I think that was a lab or was that a golden retriever? I don't know what it was. I'm getting pictures now. Paul just sent me a picture of the dog that he had to put down 3 years ago because the dog had bad cancer. A picture of him with his kid says, "Isn't this dog worth every penny?" So I think that's the way most people feel, except for Robert, who said he just dumped the dog out at the emergency room door.
But, yeah, I mean, think of these numbers. There's no magic number. But Debbie and Beth spent $10,000 and $15,000 each. Debbie, think of this. Debbie spent $10,000, had to take it out of her 401k. Beth is driving back from the can center or whatever the hell you call those things, where you redeem the things for 5 cents a pop. And she says, I think seriously, because she's got to try to recoup the $15,000 she spent on her Pomeranian.
Abigail says her horse is on a wellness plan. He just got his flu shot. There you go.
Well, that makes
sense. She hasn't gotten one herself, but the horse has got the flu shot.
We only have a couple of seconds here. Joan in Worcester, you literally have 60 seconds. Shoot. Sorry.
I have 60 seconds. First time caller. I absolutely love your show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Now, is it true you did get implants for your dog?
No, that was not true. That's why I shouldn't say things like that. That was a joke.
Breast implants,
obviously, it didn't go over very well. No, that's not true. By the way, there are things called nudicles, though.
Nudicles.
Which are true. We forgot about that. Which are
testicles.
Fake testicles. Because male dogs allegedly lose their self-esteem.
They get embarrassed at the dog park.
But I'm taking your time, Joan.
After
go ahead.
They're neutered.
That's okay. Well, my dog just had 23 teeth removed.
Oh.
Oh, my God.
I know. He's a little Yorkie. He's the love of my life. His name is Tuffy. And he's gumming things now. He has back teeth, but for a while I called him Tuffy because he would hold on to that toy and just shake it. Well, he couldn't lift it up.
Oh.
But no, he's gumming it, and he can hold on to it with his gums, so he's doing well. But he has lymphangiectasia, and that's a gastrointestinal thing.
I don't think we need to know much about that. Yeah.
Joan, how much did it cost for 23 teeth removed?
That wasn't bad. It was only like $300.
Oh.
God,
not
how
bad
it cost
at all.
Me $1,000 for 4 teeth?
You did? You didn't tell us that.
Yes, 4 teeth was $1,000.
Joan, we got to go. Thanks for your first call. This is incredible. Would you have expected this from...
No, I would not have expected this. People are very emotional about their pets. Absolutely no doubt about it. Absolutely no doubt about it. Okay.
I can't believe you're not writing a column about this, by the way.
I should be writing a column about this, but I'm not. Okay, we are done.
Thank you
very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. We're going to be at the library tomorrow. I don't think I have the sheet, Jim, that tells us what we're doing tomorrow. Do you know what we're doing tomorrow?
Yeah, Trini Kuznarek is going to be there. Corby Kummer, a food writer. Oh, and Brian O'Donovan is going to preview Celtic Christmas. I'm going this year. I've been reading about it all over the place. Sounds fabulous, like it always is.
Okay, what's on TV?
A couple things. Helen Drinan, president of Simmons College, who wrote a really powerful piece about her interaction with this archdiocese when she worked at Caritas Christi. She's got some recommendations about how the church should behave in the future. Adam Riley was up at that hearing in the Merrimack Valley about the after effect of Columbia gas. And we're going to talk politics, too, so that's all tonight.
Okay, I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Arjun Singh, Jason Tureski, Tori Bedford, and our engineer is John the Claw Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
How much do you think our staff would spend to keep us upright?
Not much, Jim.
I would say at least for one of us,
yeah,
not much.
Yeah, they might pass a hat around once.
I don't think
see
so.
See how far they get.
Oh, and I'm Jim Browdy, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Bye.